Let's call the Jobs Conference Committee to order, and we'll start out with Commissioner Phillips. We'll continue your list. We have quite a few people want to testify, so we can be as fast as we possibly can, but yet thorough.
Mr. Chairman,
we want to hear every one of your words of wisdom.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You got that copy.
Senator Lilly, you're
what his points were.
Good afternoon.
Leading the effort today? Great. Again, Mark Phillips, Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And we were on number three, and we talked about vocational rehabilitation services and the issues revolving around if we do not match all the federal money and how we would have to curtail some of our tiers of people with disabilities would be unable to receive services. And I also wanted to have the opportunity for Dick Strong. I think he was just starting his comments when we were interrupted yesterday. So with that, I would let Dick make a comment about the state services for the blind.
Thank you. Give your name for the record, please.
Richard Strong, Director of State Services for the Blind, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
If State Services for the Blind doesn't receive the a match of $150,000 for each year of the biennium, we're going to have some very tough decisions to make. Could be implementing an order of selection, as Ms. Peck referenced yesterday. We'd be limiting our vocational rehabilitation services to individuals with the most significant disabilities, or perhaps closing all categories in our order of selection if it became necessary. That would be denying services to eligible individuals in Minnesota who are blind. Other options that we would need to consider very seriously is limiting the services that are provided through our communication center. We do provide access to print materials in accessible formats for Minnesotans who have barriers to accessing print, including the provision of Braille materials to children in the K-12 program through an interagency agreement that we have with the Department of Education that funds a portion of the expense of that service. We would also be looking very seriously at limiting services of our senior services unit, which provides services to over 3,500 older blind Minnesotans each year, assisting them to maintain their independent living situation and not move to a more restrictive living environment. Those are the tough choices that we'd be faced if we were not to receive the money needed for the federal match. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Strong?
Strong, as in character or whatever.
Yes, sir. Mr. Strong, how much is the federal match?
The federal match for our vocational rehabilitation program is, as Ms. Peck described it, basically 78.7 cents of federal money is gained when we put up little less than a quarter of federal state dollars to draw down that federal money.
Could you give me an approximate figure overall, Ms. Peck?
Yeah, for the record, Kimberly Peck, Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. For every $1 that the state puts on the table, the federal government puts up $3.71.
He's talking about what's being proposed.
What's being proposed.
Real dollars.
Okay. In terms of what would be, in the event that we're not able to pull down all of the federal money for federal fiscal year 11, we will be returning $7.6 million by September 30th this year. Next year, we'll be returning an additional $11 million.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any members have any questions
these two.
For Ms. Peck or Ms. Strong? Mr. Strong. You must thoroughly impress everybody with all your knowledge. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Commissioner, next.
Yes. Number four in the letter has to do with the back to the competitive grant program, but in relation to our Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program and dislocated workers. So I asked Mr. Caligiuri to come back up again and talk a little bit about the issue of putting that into the same competitive pool as some of the other pass-throughs, when in fact it is an internal deed program, that in our Minnesota Youth Program are different than the other pass-throughs because these are actually programs we run within DEED. So I'll let Rick talk a little bit about that.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record. Mr. Caligiuri.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Rick Caligiuri, and I direct employment and training programs at DEED. And Mr. Chair and members, both the Dislocated Worker Program and the Minnesota Youth Program are fundamentally delivered through the local partners. The state is divided into 16 workforce service areas. Each of those workforce service areas has a workforce investment board, and that workforce investment board is comprised of local elected officials and local business representation. So the decisions on how to administer and put out these grants at the local level are by local elected officials and local business. They are competitive grants at the local level. Many of the workforce service areas bid out their grants every year, and many of them are on performance-based contracts. And the oversight and the infrastructure is all at the local level. To take these programs and put them back in DEED, as far as how we administer, how we account for them, takes away that whole local component.
So you are not in favor of the competitive part of the Senate's proposal?
Mr. Chairman, I think our point is there are issues around the pass-throughs being on a competitive basis, and I think you've probably been hearing from some of those people. But these are two programs that DEED operates using our local workforce regional associations as the mechanism. And so it's like apples and oranges here. We want to make sure that we talk about those separately from the other pass-through accounts. These are internal.
So in your opinion, these are not pass-through accounts. These are in-house accounts.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, again, using the youth program as an example, the city of Minneapolis targets gangs, and that's their prerogative. They're local elected officials, business members, et cetera. They target kids and gangs. The folks in Rochester may target kids aging out of foster homes. And, you know, that is their policy direction. And if you take that away, you take that local component and local priorities away.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the members? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Number five in the letter, funding reduction for Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program would severely limit resources for employers looking to retain employees through training. The cumulative impact of these reductions and the reductions made in 10 and 11 would total about $3 million, a 45% reduction of these funds, resulting in about 15 fewer projects awarded, 6,500 fewer workers would receive training, and approximately 35 businesses would not be served on an annual basis. So I just wanted to point out the effects of this so when you're making your contemplating your decisions, you understand what is happening with those kinds of reductions. And I don't know if we have any most people are familiar with the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program, but if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add that there's kind of a cumulative effect of these cuts, and the fact that Mr. Chair will remember that there were cuts in fiscal year 10 and 11, and so cumulatively this program has been cut every year for about the last five.
I'm aware that any questions from the members, they fully understand what the Job Skills Partnership is about and what the 35 businesses that won't be served will be missing.
Mr. Chairman, and very often this program is packaged along with Minnesota Investment Fund money when we're trying to attract an expansion to Minnesota. It is one of the things that can be actually used as an incentive to a company that wants to locate in Minnesota. If you tell them, if you open here, one of the burdens that a business has when they open a new operation in a different state or a different community is they have to train that workforce. And so it's very often, the chairman remember projects like AgCorp or whatever, we put job skill partnership money on the table along with Minnesota Investment Fund. So it actually acts as an incentive to for companies to locate here.
The one project that I remember the most is when Ford Motor Company came to visit the speaker, then Speaker Swigum. He didn't know a lot about the Job Skills Partnership, so he sent me down to Room 10 to talk to them. And the thing that they were most interested in is getting a Job Skills Partnership grant to give them lean manufacturing skills from St. Paul College. And I think that played somewhat into having them still here in some form or another. And they were very interested in the fact that we're the only state that offered that. And it's something, it would have been the biggest job skill partnership grant at the time, I think, ever given. So it does have a lot to do with having employers decide to move to Minnesota.
Right,
thank you. Any other questions on that program? Thank you.
Again, number six, youth programs in the proposed House and Senate version are eliminated or underfunded. The elimination or reduction to various youth programs would meet thousands of unemployed youth in communities around the state. In these communities, crime rates would go up as youth are unemployed. Two programs would be particularly effective. To cut the Minnesota youth program means 7,000 youth would not be employed. To cut youth build means that 800 youth would not be employed. And just a comment on this. Been working with the governor on some solutions for a targeted area in North Minneapolis, and what I've learned from that is that if you can get a youth a summer job and keep them, you also increase the likelihood that they are going to go back to school and continue their education, everything. So it's kind of a continuum. So it really begins in keeping them off the streets and employed at summer employment. So is any other...
Mr. Chair, I believe, though, that the youth employment unemployment rate is about 24% right now. And for the last 2 years, and it will continue this summer, most of the jobs that kids normally get in the summer are going to be taken by adults. Mm-hmm. So that exacerbates this problem.
Commissioner, I don't believe we did eliminate any youth programs completely in the House, and I don't believe the Senate did either. They put them in a competitive grant situation. So if they're going to be eliminated, it probably will be by your department.
30% cuts. Mr. Chair, I think we're very concerned about the House side in particular. The cuts represent about 30%.
30% the first year, competitive grants the second year, is that right?
Yeah, okay. It's a good thing. I apologize for that.
It's okay.
Misunderstanding, I assure you. Go on to number seven.
Very well.
The letter. Cuts to extended employment came up here. Cuts to extended employment basic, both from the General and Workforce Development Fund, would be fewer extended employment employees would receive support. As many as 500 persons would likely to lose their jobs, and total persons being served in extended employment would be reduced from roughly 5,400 in the current year to 4,800. The subsequent loss in wages for the biennium would be about $3 million. And I have Kimberly Peck, if you would like to make a comment on that.
Ms. Peck.
Again, Kimberly Peck, for the record, Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. The Extended Employment Program is unique to Minnesota. It provides resources to provide ongoing supports for individuals with significant disabilities who, absent those supports, would not be able to be competitively employed. So certainly with the proposed reductions, the impact would be, as Commissioner Phillips indicated, loss of jobs. And because individuals are those with significant disabilities, they would then, as a result, have to rely on public benefits. So I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Any questions from the members, either Senator or the House? What was that? They were put in the competitive grant program. They are normally funded at about $12 million per biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, the extended employment program is funded about 60% by workforce development funds and the balance by the general fund. And it's a total of about $13 million.
Okay, how are they doing getting their contracts for piece work and so forth throughout the state?
Mr. Chair, the extended employment program is an outcome-based program. So the community rehabilitation providers who provide the community-based support for individuals on the job site are only able to earn their contract by reporting hours worked. So it clearly is an outcome-based program. If there aren't enough hours worked by individuals with significant disabilities, we're not able to pay out the full contract amount to the community rehab providers. So it clearly is outcome-based. It's a model that I find very effective.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Commissioner, love to hear your remarks.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my going through the letter. Myself and my staff will be here as you're going through your bill, and we'd be happy to answer any questions anytime. I do have one housekeeping measure that I management and budget. You recall our conversation about the contamination fund, and apparently the previous session, they tried to clean up a lot of special general fund accounts in the accounting department of the state of Minnesota. And because our contaminated cleanup money comes from four different accounts, they neglected to set up the special revenue accounts to accumulate those four. So they provided, management and budget provided this. It's been provided to your staff, to Mr. Jensen, and I think that it's something that will be fine, and I just wanted to mention it to the whole committee, so in case that comes up in your deliberations about taking, it's really a housekeeping measure. It doesn't affect any budgeting or anything like that. It's a better way to account for those contamination cleanup monies.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Do you have questions?
Yes. Commissioner, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. So, Commissioner, we've been through a number of the changes and heard input from the agency, from you, and from many folks. We do have a limited budget to work with, and we understand that the governor has a different perspective than the legislature does. But assuming the budget that we are working with in the legislature, are there other changes that you see that would be less burdensome than those that we have recommended? Or do you feel that the slate that we have put forward, given the limits that we have, is a good start?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lilly, I'm not sure you're going to like my answer, but we worked really hard internally at DEED with the governor's office through a lot of negotiation to try to make his proposal that we could work with. And you're doing the same thing with all the best knowledge you can get. And I think that the preference would be that you figure out your differences in your bills, and then the governor would like to, you know, at that point in time. So I think I've told you the issues that we have with, and some of the biggest ones, obviously, are with the vocational rehabilitation money. Minnesota, other than one unallotment that was done, we've never not fully matched the federal money for voc rehab and state services for the blind. So, I mean, that's a grave concern to me that we're going to underserve or not be able to serve so many people with disabilities. I have concerns about all these things. There's a great programs that you're going to hear from today, people. So the governor tried to preserve all of those in his proposal. The competitive process, you know, you can set up criteria all you want. Is something going to fall through the cracks in that process? Possibly a very good program that's serving youth somewhere or something. So I have concerns about those things. But so you're wrestling the same things that I wrestled with the governor's office. So,
all right. Thank you.
All right, just stand ready to help you do your work. If I can, again, as you're conferring, if you need help from my staff or myself, be happy to do that.
Commissioner, we're looking forward to your assistance in trying to get to an agreed-upon goal of getting this omnibus bill passed and signed by the governor. It starts out like a very, very tough job, but I'm sure with your help we'll make it a little smoother.
Great. Thank you.
And next we have Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's Commissioner Mary Tingerthal. So we can talk about the requests that she has in her agency. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Tingerthal, the commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. You should have a letter in your package that discusses the impact of the proposed reductions from the governor's budget. The first item is the one that is impacted by both the Senate and the House position, and that's a reduction in funding of the Housing Trust Fund, which is our program that serves those who are most in need and most vulnerable. And the cuts would be between $2 million in the Senate bill and $2.5 million in the House bill, which would impact our ability to assist between 300 and 370 families, veterans, and disabled persons that would lose their rental assistance and be at risk of becoming homeless again. And one of the things we talked about when we appeared before the committees was the fact that this will tend to have a negative impact on state and local public dollars as these families show up in emergency shelters, jails, and the emergency room. This is a very cost-effective program when compared to any of those alternatives. One of the additional pieces of information since we testified before your committees is that the federal government's budget this year is now final. And we've learned that one of the programs that we work with on these rental assistance programs is a voucher program for veterans, which in the federal budget has now been cut by 50% beyond what we anticipated. So what was already going to be a negative impact in the budget proposed by the governor now will have an even greater impact because of the cuts at the federal level. Questions about that provision?
Commissioner, you could tell me the federal funds that we are not going to be able to access because of our funding levels?
Those are specifically housing vouchers for veterans. That program was cut by 50% beyond the level where we thought it would be when we testified before your committee.
Housing vouchers for veterans. Can you give me an approximate amount of money you're losing or missing out on?
I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Orr if she can look that up, and we can perhaps circle back to that.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, provision number two. This is a position where the Senate position is equal to the governor's proposal, and the House position is $1 million less. This will result in our ability to preserve 42 fewer federally assisted housing units. These are units that may be lost to the permanent affordable housing stock because of condition issues. And the big impact number here to look at is the fact that the big loss, if those units are lost and not retained, is the $5 million in federal funding that come with the Section 8 rental assistance that comes with those units. So while 42 units may not sound like a lot, the impact is not a one-year impact, but a multi-year impact of having lost those units essentially forever. Questions on that? Funding in item three under the Challenge Program, which is our development program for both multifamily and single.
Can I backstep one?
Yes, please.
One deal on number two. In order to access a federal Section 8 housing voucher, what would be the approximate income level a person would have to be at in order to get one, assuming they were available?
Yeah, these are not vouchers. These are actual Section 8 units, which are typically below 50% of median income. And these are particularly valuable because they provide the renter with enough assistance to make up the difference between the rents and the units, which are capped by federal law, and 30% of that homeowner's or not, that renter's income.
30% of their income. Okay, thank you.
Under item number three, under the further cut proposed by the House of approximately $200,000, funding under the Challenge Program would reach 20 fewer properties, which these dollars have been focused primarily in neighborhoods hard hit by the foreclosure crisis. I think, as you've seen in the press, the last few days, unfortunately, that slide in housing values and the recovery of those neighborhoods has still not turned the corner. Item number four is, I would say, a technical change. We won't go a lot into that. There's just a set-aside number that is not the same proportion as it has been in the past, and we think that was probably an inadvertent change that because the overall dollar amount has not changed. In item five, this is one also that has been impacted to a greater degree since we testified before the committees. We would be looking under the House bill at $300,000 less than the governor's budget, allowing us to assist 1,250 fewer households with counseling. This impact is, again, much greater now that we know the outcome of the current year's federal budget, where, astoundingly to us, the federal homebuyer counseling program at HUD has been completely eliminated. Now, this is not for foreclosure prevention. This is for first-time homebuyers that are considering a home purchase for the first time. For example, we require at Minnesota Housing that before you get one of our mortgages that you must have home buyer counseling. We do that to try to prevent homeowners from getting into a decision that isn't right for them. And as a result, our program has considerably lower foreclosure rate than the state as a whole. And so we did think we could squeak by on this, but with the reduction in the federal program, again, this will be much harder hit than we had thought it would be at the time we testified before the committee.
Commissioner, is there any thought of private sector or nonprofit counseling done for some of these people? Could they duplicate what's done here? Stuff like Lutheran Social Services and stuff like that. I think they've attempted to do some. We're missing counseling for 1,250 people. Is there any way the private sector and philanthropic giving can make up some of that in your mind?
Mr. Chair, members, we have in Minnesota one of the finest counseling networks of anywhere in the country, led by the Minnesota Homeownership Center. And they are working as closely as any organization in the country with several large lenders, as well as with Fannie Mae, that just, in fact, recognized their program about 2 weeks ago, where they've actually placed someone in their office to work together with the nonprofit counselors there. So I think if there's any organization that is leveraging private resources for counseling, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone getting more leverage out of the state dollars than our counseling organizations here in Minnesota. But the fact of the matter remains that there are thousands of families that are still facing foreclosure that are unable to be assisted in a timely manner, even with those good efforts with several of our large lenders.
Commissioner, I see Representative Mahoney here, and he kind of told me how in his neighborhood that he lives in, how he could see the different phases of foreclosures happening with the signs in front of the houses and so forth. Do you think that there is a big change? Are we getting through the foreclosures in the urban cities, and now is it spreading to other areas of the state or the metro area, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, members, our agency did a study earlier this year that in fact shows that foreclosure levels are in fact improving in the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and that in fact the greatest impact, that where foreclosures are still growing rather than shrinking, are in the counties surrounding the core cities, and especially in the outer counties outside of the seven-county metro area, the so-called collar counties, where foreclosures are still growing at a frightening pace. I keep hoping that we're coming to the light at the end of the tunnel, but we still have, unfortunately, a long way to go. But we are making progress. One area I'd like to cite as a success story is that with our agency mortgages, we're working very hard with our loan servicer to do what's called loss mitigation in the business, meaning working to keep the family in their home by modifying their mortgage. And since they're mortgages that are on our balance sheet, we're able to negotiate pretty effectively. And we have seen a dramatic drop just in the last month of some of these modifications have kicked in. We don't count the loan as current until it's been current for 4 months, so we make sure it's all settled in. But we did see a dramatic drop in the month of March in our delinquency levels, partly because of those efforts. So we think the most effective thing is whenever possible, when there's a family in that home, not an investor, but a family in that home, that we're keeping them in that home if it makes sense for them.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Okay.
Item number six moves us to our homeowner assistance fund. This is our down payment and closing cost assistance fund. This program over the years has allowed us to target our mortgage revenue bond resources. Those are the tax-exempt mortgages or tax-exempt bonds that we sell to provide funding for mortgages, to target those resources to a lower income group of folks than anyone, any other housing finance agency in the country. We also here have had an unexpected reduction in another resource that we use to help with homeownership assistance, and that is the federal home program, which has also been reduced in the current year budget. And under that, 125 fewer families than we thought we would be able to assist when we appeared before your committees will now receive assistance. So these are two pots of money that we use side by side to leverage each other. So if we lose another 30, that'll be a total of 155 families that will not receive down payment assistance. One of the things we see in our statistics is that the pace of new home buying is still very, very slow, as you no doubt know in your districts, and think that it's an excellent time for home buyers to be making that step. Housing costs are at some of their lowest in history, in recent history, together with low interest rates, make it really a very good time for home buyers to make that step. And this is one of the tools that allow us to bring home buyers back into some of our hard-hit communities and also into even areas where new housing may be built. Okay. Item number 7 is a change that is in the House bill only. This is where we're directed to charge a 2% interest rate on loans under our Homeownership Assistance Fund program. We would like to request that this change be dropped for very practical reason. The average loan amount under this program is $4,250. So at a 2% interest rate, that's $85 per year. And one of the things about this program, although we do get a fair amount of recovery of these loans because we record them as a lien on the property, so if the home buyer does sell the property, we get that property back. The simple act of adding an interest rate, which may on the surface seem like a really good, smart idea, means that our loan servicer then, instead of having it just be a flat amount, has to now have it on a loan servicing system that accrues interest, assigns it to the mortgage, has to report that to the borrower because it's an interest expense. And what that means is it moves from sort of a passive part of the loan servicing system to an active part of the loan servicing system. I used to work for a company that ran a loan servicing system, and typically they would charge as much as $100 a month or a year for servicing an interest-bearing loan as compared to a completely deferred loan where there is no interest. Now, it sounds maybe like that's a lot, but it's the fact of the matter that it puts them into a whole different level of reporting and disclosure that they need to do. So we're afraid that with this requirement, very well-intentioned, that it would simply be eaten up in servicing costs. So we would respectfully request that you consider dropping that.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, as I recall, my kids, when they were in college, took out some loans, and they had both interest and they had fees. And if it's burdensome to charge interest, could this be just added on as a fee so that you don't have to accumulate that software or that tracking? That basically, if you borrow $1,000, at really what you're borrowing is $1,085, if those numbers are correct.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator, you're suggesting that we perhaps consider a different approach, that the home buyer would simply know that if they borrowed $4,000, their repayment amount at the end, if they moved, would be $4,100 or something like that.
Yes.
We could certainly consider that.
Mr. Chair, so that might alleviate the challenge that you have to this proposal.
That would certainly simplify the process. We have not had those conversations with servicers, but would certainly simplify the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, item number 8, under this program, the reduction is about $370,000 under the House bill, and would result in 32 fewer affordable rental units being rehabilitated at the proposed funding level. We have just been in the process of doing a series of meetings in Greater Minnesota, and it is in Greater Minnesota that this particular resource is most important. I would particularly like to call your attention to the fact that we have struck up a new discussion with our colleagues at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development Division. We have a good friend who is a former county commissioner, Colleen Landkammer, who now directs that office. And we are really committed to trying to preserve the rural development projects that many of which need a reinvestment of capital dollars to make sure that they're viable housing. Many of them, frankly, need new owners. And this rental rehabilitation program is one that would be commonly used in trying to preserve those rural development units. Minnesota, I learned on this trip, has more rural development rental assistance program units than any state in the country. It's a precious resource, particularly for our rural communities, and but it does need a reinvestment of dollars, and this is a pot of money that, as we've talked with our colleagues around the state, is one that they see very important towards that usage. And finally, item number nine is around our capacity building program. This is a program, it's small dollars but big impact, where it's generally used to assist in helping local organizations apply for dollars for homeless prevention assistance under the federal McKinney-Vento Act. So it's, again, small dollars to help prepare applications. And as I think you know, as tough as it is to deal with homeless issues in the Twin Cities, even tougher in greater Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I do have an answer on your question about the veterans assistance vouchers, if you would care to go back to that. We were assuming that under the previous budget that there would be $75 million nationally for veterans assistance vouchers, which would have been 11,500 vouchers, and instead there will be 7,600 vouchers by the reduction. So it's gone from 75 million nationally to 50 million, and Minnesota PHAs received 70 of the 10,000 units. So, again, about a third reduction in that, so probably down to about 45 units.
Thank you.
Any questions from the members? For Mr. Tingerthal or Tanya Orr? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. In your opinion, is there anything that comes to the priority, the highest priority, that you wish this conference committee to attend to?
Mr. Chair and members, when we presented to your committees, we shared with you that in our discussions with the governor in preparing his budget, that we did give a set of priorities, and that was for those most vulnerable. We did not present an across-the-board set of cuts to the programs. Rather, we prioritized holding harmless the programs for those who are homeless and most in need. And so we were, in fact, disappointed to see that the one place that the Senate bill does cut is in those homeless programs. So those cuts did not reflect our priorities.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your presentation. I suppose we might as well start on this list. Mm-hmm. Next we have Maureen Kenny, Northern Connections from Perham, Minnesota. Is Maureen Kenny here? Coming, okay, great. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, and we're anxious to hear your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Maureen Kenny. I am the Executive Director of Northern Connections in Perham, Minnesota. Northern Connections serves a 12-county area in west central and northwestern Minnesota. assisting individuals transitioning off cash assistance programs. And I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today, and I really want to just make myself available to any questions or concerns you have. There are a couple things I would like to bring to the table, and that is our funding levels. On the House side, our funding is proposed to be reduced by 50%. We traditionally had been receiving $200,000 a year, and the House is proposing a reduction to $100,000. On the Senate side, it's proposing it to go into that competitive bidding process. I want to make sure the committee is aware that our organization has also been identified by the Legislative Task Force, the Ladders Out of Poverty Task Force, as a model to be replicated across additional counties in greater Minnesota. So my concern with that is, as our base operational funding is on the table for reduction, we're also being asked to expand our services because we have a model that's cost-effective and does work. In response to the competitive grant process, we have been partnering with DEED. We have been measuring data, trying to quantify the impact we have on individuals and on the community. So we are actually, we understand that process, that that's the direction that our service, our performance needs to go. My concern is that it would be a shame to rush that process and ignore other duplicative efforts in the state. DEED already has accountability measures that we report to every 6 months. To move to a process that creates another layer of administration in a short time frame for either this July 1 or even the next July 1, I think is rushing the process. I think it would be better to bring individuals and organizations to the table, define what best practice is, develop those standards and metrics, and then hold the organizations that are being funded by the state accountable to those measures. So I really am here to just field any questions that the committee might have, to make sure you understand who we are, the services we provide. We've been grateful to be state-funded, and we're hoping to be able to expand our services in the future.
Representative Sanders has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just along those lines there, you were just talking about, could you kind of walk me through what you guys do for job training, workforce development, how you help people get jobs, some of those things like you were saying? I'd like to learn a little bit more about what you guys do.
Absolutely. Chairman, Representative Sanders. Northern Connections focuses on four main areas: reemployment, job retention, career advancement, and asset accumulation. We receive our clients from the 12 counties that we serve as they're transitioning off Minnesota Family Investment Program and the Diversionary Work Program. Those customers are referred to us. We have a telephonic human services approach. So we contact those individuals, find out where they're at, what their goal area is. If they're not employed, we focus on reemployment. Get them a job, get them working. If they are employed, are they making a livable wage to support their families? If they're not making a livable wage, we work with them to either advance their degree, their credentialing, find a better job, find a different job. We also, one of our primary focuses is addressing the barriers that individuals in rural Minnesota face that are unique, and that's public transportation is non-existent. Child care is difficult and often not available at second and third shift. So we also address the whole person. What are the barriers to that person being able to stay employed and support their families? So that's the reemployment, job retention. We really work with individuals. We are their coach, their counselor. If they're thinking of, if they're having trouble at the workplace, either with a coworker or a supervisor, we coach them through how to deal with that instead of either being terminated or them quitting that job. Stay employed. That's the focus. And we're the person they can turn to that's not going to pass a judgment, but rather refer them to resources in the community, talk through a plan, set up a plan to help them continue on a path towards stability.
Okay. Can you tell me the outcomes of all your wonderful work? How many people have jobs? How many people have received a positive outcome from Northern Connections?
I don't have maybe the specific numbers you're looking for, but I can get some information to you. But what I can tell you, since we started serving customers in 2006, we've served over 1,000 individuals. And we are not a time-limited program. The only reason we would close out a relationship is if that person felt they were stable. We will work with a person until they believe they are financially stable. So we're a long-term program. We have some folks that we've been working with since 2006. We are continuously expanding. People don't sunset off our program just because they've been on it two or three years. We measure 72 different data points related to six categories. The reemployment, job retention, career advancement, asset accumulation, information sharing, and referral. We do something called blast calls. If we know that there's a program in someone's community, school backpack program, school lunch program, a food drop, we pull up those names and we call those folks and tell them there's something available in your community, you should have access to it. So we have lots of numbers. We have lots of data that we collect on the thousands of activities we do per month and the outcomes that that relates to. And I'd be happy to send you a summary of those categories and the sort of outcomes. As far as people either gaining a job or retaining a job, we have people on job retention goals, and we check in and make sure that they have still those jobs. I can pull those numbers for you.
That'd be great.
What we're starting to collect is also hours per week and wages per hour so that we can hopefully put together a formula to demonstrate the economic impact we're having across these 12 counties in rural Minnesota.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative
Lilly. Mr. Chair.
Senator Lilly.
Yes, thank you. So let's talk about the competitive grant situation a little bit. Currently, so you've been funded since 2006 through the legislature. How many times have you had contact with the legislature? What has been our input into your organization? And what are the questions that we have been asking over time that tell you that we're paying attention to how well you're doing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lilly, first I have to acknowledge I joined the organization last June.
Okay.
So I'm going to answer the question as best I can.
I'm rather new here at the Senate also. So.
I think a testimony to start out with is just that our organization has been identified by a legislative task force. I understand it was 2 or 3 years ago there was the Legislative Commission to End Poverty did a statewide tour to look for organizations that were having a positive impact on poverty. And Representative Lanning was in that group. Senator Marty, I think, did the tour. I forget who was on that tour. Some people in the room probably know the answer to this. But they identified that we were a unique program serving the issues of rural Minnesota. Since then, I do know that the representatives and senators in our area have been very actively involved in our organization. They attend our annual meeting. They did in September. Since I started in last June, I have made a point to reach out and meet the majority of them and talk about what they need in their community, how we are delivering on the dollars that the state has given us. And it's been an amazing journey to get to know Senator Hoffman, to get to know Representative Murdoch, Representative Lanning, Representative Franzen, Representative Nornes, and I'm forgetting half of them. But to partner, because we see it as a partnership. And the same goes with DEED. I met Commissioner Phillips on his first week on the job. We have a member from DEED on our board of directors as an advisor to our board, so that we are in constant communication partnership with DEED, because that's where the monies are coming through, but then also through answering back to the state what we're doing, what needs we're meeting for the public good in the areas that we serve. And I don't know how many times people have been here to testify. I presume every biennium for funding. But beyond that, I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you for having me.
Ms. Hess from the Inventors Congress is next. All the way from Redwood Falls.
All the way from Redwood Falls. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you said, my name is Mrs. Hess, Deb Hess from Redwood Falls, and I have the honor of serving as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Inventors Congress. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and I've been with the organization for 27 years. For 21 years, I did this as a volunteer, spending between 10 and 30 hours a week with the organization, and for 6 years, I've served as the director. And I truly believe that our core function is supporting economic development and creating jobs. It is just that we have a different structure, which has evolved in our 54 years to meet the needs of customers based on their input. There's a handout that's coming around with my notes, so I'll paraphrase a lot of it instead of reading it literally, except a few key points. You know, I've been following a lot of the discussion about the competitive grant process, and we just don't fit into that typical model. We don't fit in the description of creating jobs. Based on the suggested language, it appears that it could be very hard for us to even qualify for those grants. We are unique. There is no other organization like ours in the country. And in our 54-year history, we have connected thousands of product developers with those resources, with over 5,000 of them exhibiting at our expo, and supported them through that process. We have many repeat clients, and inventors come from all walks of life and at every stage of developing their ideas. We are not a tourist event that happens in Redwood Falls each year, but we are designed to foster creativity and innovation, and the expo is a part of our programming and is one step in the process, and that's called test marketing. But the vast majority of the appropriation we have received since 1985 has been used to fund our year-round office, providing that knowledgeable staff and the support for those inventors. And it is about a half of our budget, and the rest is raised from fees and donations. Regarding the accountability from the state, I truly understand and respect the need for accountability and have welcomed the oversight. We have submitted timely reports for each and every appropriation we have received since 1985. And to my knowledge, which is about the time I came on board, we have never been asked to make changes or adjustments to our programming based on any misappropriations of those state funds. And I have great respect for the difficult decisions that you have to make as a former county commissioner. So I just pleading our case that the two options that you are considering, we prefer the House's version, where we would receive the $50,000 appropriation and not go through the competitive grant process. That appropriation would allow us to plan for the year to provide and improve the programs that meet the needs of our clients. So, you know, going from $85,000 to $50,000 in the past 2 years, we're already having to revise the ability for us to continue providing the same programs. I have two examples in the handout, but one is from an inventor who contacted our office and exhibited at our show, and he talks about the shark-infested waters as he sought to capitalize in his invention. And he actually has his product being produced in Minnesota. The stainless steel blank cuts are manufactured and cut in Stacy. They're formed and packaged and shipped from Bemidji, and pouches for his stoves are in Rosso. And the name of the company is Little Bug Stoves. And what he talks about is, I think, is really key when I talked about not fitting into a typical mold, is he uses the services of graphic designers, printers, web developers, accountants, law firms, and shippers. He doesn't necessarily have a lot of employees, but he is the CEO of an S corporation in the state of Minnesota, and he contributes our organization for that success. And the other example is a typical call in our office to our Inventors Resource Center, and you can read up on that. But what we do is help educate inventors about the importance of connecting with the people who are directly related to the industries their product are a part of and how to avoid the invention promotion scam companies that target inventors. And they are prolific, and I can give you very intimate details about the success ratios of those companies. And the other thing that we do very, very, very well is to leverage the dollars that we receive. Our 17 speakers that are coming in for the workshops this year, we do not pay any of their lodging, any of their airfare. We do not pay speaking fees. And as I calculate those costs over the years, it ranges between $24,000 and $28,000. So we truly, in a nutshell, provide year-round staff that connects inventors to the information and experts that they need to get their products into the marketplace. I want to thank you for your support over the years. And because of your commitment, we serve well over 2,000 inventors a year through the Resource Center. And as I said, we are unique in the United States. There's not a single organization that does what we do. And the state appropriation is the core funding for this organization and for us to be here in 2012. And just thank you for your time. And again, you have my notes there, and you also have the cards with the information about our Inventors Resource Center and information about this year's expo. So if you have inventors who are looking for opportunities for help, send them our way.
Deb, just out of curiosity, what do you do for inventors that invent something that have no idea how they can have patents and so forth? You probably the only place in Minnesota that we can get information on patenting a product, is that correct?
Well, you know, there's a lot of information out there. What I hear when people call our office, and it's through email, by phone, I get letters in the mail from people. You know, a lot of them will call and say, you know, I need to get a patent right away. I have an idea. And the first conversation I have with them is how important it is for them to learn that getting a patent isn't the first part of the process. When I speak to the William Mitchell College of Law intellectual property law students, they have no clue where in the process getting a patent fits in. They think they need to do it immediately. But getting a patent happens when you're at the stage in your business plan that it actually fits, that it's appropriate to spend the $3,500 to the $15,000 applying for a patent, and you're going to be able to make money on that investment. It isn't something you do right away, so we teach them the steps, how you start with your inventor's notebook and begin doing that research, doing a patent search to find out if you're imposing on somebody else's rights, finding out what else is out there similar, looking into the market and determining that there's actually a market for the products that they're developing. But it's different for each person because they come at different stages in the process. So we have a free toolkit that people download on our website, and we walk through. That's one of the tools I use. It's over 30 pages, and we start with the beginning, and we keep in contact, and we work through that process.
The Governor's Workforce Development Council. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hess, do you guys charge your clients a fee if they come to you guys, or is it a free service?
It has been free. We have, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the way we were structured from the very beginning is we are an education system, and we have tried to come up with the revenue to generate models to sell resources. But amazingly, there are times when I spent time with a woman yesterday, and she's from, New Richmond? Yeah. And her question led to about a 15-minute conversation, and I was able to direct her to a resource within her area that she had never, ever known existed. And I would probably never talk to her again. She got the help that she needed. And it's really hard in that short time frame to set up, you know, the HP model of, if I'm going to answer your question, you need to give me your credit card and charge you, you know, whatever the amount is for the services. We have always provided this free. There are fees that we charge for the expo. That is, you know, if somebody comes to test market their product to rent a booth at our space, you know, we charge fees for those kinds of things. When we host workshops, we charge for those.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up. Ms. Hess, how many, on an annual basis, how many clients do you guys serve?
and that's a difficult question to answer because people come at us in different ways. When I did my reporting for the deed grant, you know, for this the recent appropriation, we've always kept track by number of contacts. And last year in the biennial, or the, you know, July through June, we had 2,806 inventors contact our office, 1,514 businesses, and that doesn't include service providers, volunteers, and students that we work with throughout the years. And that may be in the services of 1,652 were for technical assistance. That means I wrote down in that time frame, I answered a question, you know, and then 1,315 partnership networking opportunities where we're working with other resources to help direct them. You know, when I'm working with the William Mitchell College of Law IP Clinic, when I'm working with the Small Business Development Center staff or director, you know, and working with their counselors to help them understand why they would come to us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you.
And next on our list, we have Alan Pernes. I think that's a deaf and hard of hearing. Barnes? No, not Hartner.
Mr.
Welcome to our committee. Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnan, and I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We are a non-cabinet state agency that advocates for and with people that are deaf, blind, and hard of hearing. That's 10% of the state's population. I have here today a number of folks who wanted to talk about the reduction by 15% of the grants for the Minnesota Employment Center for Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and the by 15% and the reduction on 30% for the Vector program for transition age youth, and then elimination of that program and putting it into competitive bidding process on the House side, and then putting the Senate's position of putting both grants into the competitive bidding process on the Senate side. 20% of people with disabilities are engaged in the workforce. That percentage has not increased 1% since the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed in 1990. And it actually has gone down about 2% over the last year with a decline in the economy. And corresponding with that have been increases of people getting on disability assistance. And so it's to our advantage to have creative programs that are effective that help get people to work. I have here today Alan Parnes, who's the chair of our advisory committee for employment with the commission. But we also have packets for you that have copies of the reports that are sent on the annual report, but copies of the report that are sent on a quarterly basis by both the Minnesota Employment Center for Deaf and Hard of Hearing and the Vector Program for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Youth. And with that, I'll hand it over to Alan Parnes. And thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to testify today and for the funds that you provided us in the past.
Thank you. Mr. Parnes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to talk with you today about a couple of very important things. My name is Alan Parnes, and I recently retired after 42 years as a professional in the field of deafness. Most of that work had been in vocational rehabilitation services, and 22 of those years were here in Minnesota. I have been involved with both of the programs that we're discussing today, the Minnesota Employment Center and also the Vector program, and I've been involved since the beginning of both. A lot of my clients have actually been referred in the past to both of those programs. What they both do is we try to help people find jobs and keep jobs. And in general, it's very difficult for many agencies because you have to have people with specialized understanding of deafness and specialized communication skills to work with people who are deaf. And really, you need to understand that many, many deaf people rely on sign language as their primary mode of communication, and that is vital then for them. MEC has tried to help deaf people, as has Vector, to seek employment and to get that. There's also the issue of the community rehab programs. And there are clients that have disabilities, and they help to prepare people for interviews and to seek job placement. And there is such a high success rate that we have seen. And you know that let me just clarify. With just the CRPs, you look at a client who is not deaf because there isn't as high a success rate with deaf people, and many CRPs are specifically frustrated with what to do with deaf people and how to keep them employed as well as to get employment for them. And partly that's because those staff have not had communication skills, they have no knowledge about deafness, they haven't had the appropriate marketing skills and the appropriate placement skills to work with deaf people. You know, deaf people really can do absolutely anything, but you really have to market that well so that people aren't afraid or intimidated to hire somebody who's deaf. Because, to be honest, many times deaf people frighten people. They don't know what to do with us, you know, because they haven't had the kind of experience that they need. And similarly with the Vector program, they've been involved for 17 years, you know, working. I worked often with deaf and hard of hearing children in this transition age, trying to help these students who are at a high school level be prepared for making the kind of decisions they need to set up employment goals and to know what they want to do for work. And that is rarely done successfully in a traditional transition program. You might get maybe one or two people who are able to go through a traditional program and have success. But you really need to look at having a critical mass of deaf individuals so that those students can have a program that is tailor-made to them. And that way, when you have a critical mass, you can justify hiring people who have the kinds of skills that can help them with communication and the other needs that they have as a unique population. Now, the Minnesota Employment Center and Vector really are the only show in town, to be honest. You know, if you look at the 7-county metropolitan area, they really are it. There's really nothing else out there. And in greater Minnesota, it's even worse, unfortunately. So in summary, let me just say that by not cutting the funding to both of these programs, you actually will end up increasing employment for deaf people in Minnesota. So thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about those concerns.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Anderson, and I'm the program coordinator of the Minnesota Employment Center for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. MEC itself is a freestanding statewide program managed by an interagency management team. MEC's policies are set by an advisory committee comprised of members from the deaf community. And since its inception in 1993, MEC is and remains to be the only program of its kind in the state. MEC is unique because all of the staff are fluent in American Sign Language, and that they're able to assist both employers and employees to reduce and eliminate communication barriers. The communication barriers that deaf and hard of hearing people face are significant, and MEC helps them to overcome that. MEC provides extended employment services for deaf and hard of hearing Minnesotans to maintain their employment and helps employers find good, reliable employees to help with their bottom line. MEC's extended employment services include helping clients advance in their jobs as well as provide technical support to solve immediate work issues that may arise. Let me talk about how the cuts could potentially hurt MEC. On the House side, we are thankful that we have been included in the budget. A 15% cut, though, will mean laying off one staff person, which will result in at least 20 people losing the support and lead to future job losses. Job losses then lead to greater reliance on other governmental programs and long-term economic assistance. On the Senate side, not having the legislature make the employment of deaf and hard of hearing people a priority and leaving that determination up to the JTPA could lead to the elimination of the entire program.
JPTA.
And it's sad because it's taken many years to develop the kind of expertise that our staff have. Since MEC is an extended employment for deaf and hard of hearing, we would like to be given the same consideration as other extended employment programs for people with serious disabilities and mental illness, and to be taken out of the competitive bid process. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greta Palmberg, and I am a deaf and hard of hearing teacher with the Vector program. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify. And I'd also like to identify some of the impact that would be felt by this broad-based competitive bid. Serving deaf and hard of hearing youth is a low incidence population. According to the Minnesota Department of Education, the 2010 child count, there were 111 students who were deaf and hard of hearing receiving services with the ages of 18 to 21 in the state. These are the students that we're targeting for entry-level employment assistance. Currently, we serve about 25 students annually. Unfortunately, there is a real discouraging picture of the post-school experiences of young deaf and hard of hearing youth, including high unemployment, underemployment, low rates of full-time employment, and low rates of participation and retention in post-secondary education. Last year, we did an informal survey with Twin Cities deaf and hard of hearing teachers of students ages 15 to 18. And out of those 100 students that we polled, only 12 had ever had a competitive independent job. Those are those after school and summer jobs. With no work experience, without access to these entry level jobs, these students are unable to compete with their hearing peers when entering the job market. Just to illustrate this point, I want to talk about the work that and the time-intensive work that it takes to get a single entry-level position. This year, one of my students was applying to CUB for an after-school and summer job. It took our staff 20 hours to place him at the CUB Foods. In addition to preparing the student for the application process and the interview, countless hours were spent by the job coach talking to the hiring manager to even convince this person to give the student a chance for an interview. I know most of you know entry-level positions. You fill out the application, and the next step in the process is a phone interview. Well, most of our students do their phone interview through the video relay phone. So the minute you call a student to do that first initial interview, you already recognize that he's deaf because you're talking to an interpreter through the video relay. Many of our students can't even get past that point. We did get the student past that point, and he did have a face-to-face interview with our interpreters. He did very well and got the job and has been employed for the last 6 months. Now, as soon as he's got the job, he only requires occasional check-ins with the work coordinator at school. So this employment example just illustrates the amount of job assistance required to open the door for these entry-level positions. Our program is committed to change the unemployment statistics for the deaf and hard of hearing. Last year, 89% of our graduates were employed or attending post-secondary programs after graduation. We received students from a variety of communities, including Minneapolis, Roseville, Intergrove Heights, Mankato, Belle Plaine, Lakeville, Bemidji, Big Lake, South Washington County, Montgomery, Anoka, and Moorhead. Our critical mass of students who are deaf and hard of hearing is essential to providing this comprehensive transition program. 65% of our students have a second disability. 65% of our students come from low socioeconomic backgrounds. 83% of the parents cannot sign at a basic level. 87% of our students are already receiving SSI benefits. The Vector program provides this transition programming, but what makes it different is that we have collaboration with DEED through these legislative funds and the local school district. The intensive communication is provided in job coaching, career classes, job interviews, creating resumes, seeking employments, short-term vocational training experience, and employment after school, during the summer, and after graduation. We currently are in a competitive bid through DEED. In the legislature, the line item is just for a program serving, giving money for interpreters. So we do, DEED does put out a competitive bid. We have received that bid. We give yearly reports. We get yearly revisits from DEED. And then we also give DEED four quarterly reports each year. By reducing or eliminating this funding, we take away this communication resources for employment that will that results in students not being able to break through those barriers to employment. Due to the low numbers of the youth that we serve, my worry is that in a competitive bid process, we could never compete with programs that serve a large number of youth. We could also not compete due to the high labor intensive required, which is more expensive, requiring the interpreters, the time that it takes to place a student at entry-level position. So the cost of the program is probably more expensive than some of the other programs. Right now, the House is cutting us 30%, and with the second year in competitive bid, and the Senate has us in the competitive bid. If we're unable to make it through the competitive bid process, our program will cease to exist after a few years. These funds are the tipping point of our program and make it cost-effective for the school districts to send the students. Please help keep deaf and hard of hearing youth as a priority in your job youth fund. Thank you.
Ms. Palmberg, what is the difference with what you do with what Mary Hartnett does and with what the school for the deaf and hard of hearing in Faribault?
Okay.
And I believe that's funded by the Department of Education.
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mary Hartnett's program is just a vehicle for us to work through the lobby for these funding dollars. So that's the only connection we have with Mary's program. 3 or 4 years ago, she helped us write a bill so that we could have this money for interpreters to keep our program afloat because of the expense of the interpreters. What was happening was we were getting a lot of students that had mental health needs or had learning, you know, problems, but the districts were not sending students with deaf and hard of hearing because the cost was more due to the interpreters. So that kind of evens out the playing field. We partner with a lot of people. VR comes and works with our students, and we now have an MEC person. Jennifer was part of MEC that works at the school. Faribault School for the Deaf does not have the comprehensive transition program that we have. They do serve some students to age 21. Some students are continuing their high school education there. So as far as a transition program, we are probably the biggest one in the state that serves deaf and hard of hearing students.
Do they try to get employment for the people they serve in Faribault?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I can answer that question because I'm not as familiar with the program at Faribault, but I know that We do take in a number of students that were educated at Faribault, and then they come to our program when they are 18, 19, or 20. And I know some of the students that I've had in the past have had jobs, at the school.
Ms. Hartnett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the commission is a non-cabinet state agency, and actually the Minnesota Employment Center convened a group of people to address the needs of deaf and hard of hearing youth and the employment issues that they face, and adults. And so I believe it was about 20 years before I was involved with the commission, the Minnesota Employment Center actually was created as a result of a task force that was created by the commission, and then recommendations were made to the legislature, and then basically how it was started. In response to your question about the School for the Deaf, there are programs around the state, but oftentimes there is no place that has the capacity that the Vector program has, and we are working with them to try to identify other sources to try to make it so there's housing available so more students can come and participate in this program. As it stands right now, some of these students are staying with relatives in order to be able to participate. But I know that there are small transition programs around the state, but they don't have the capacity that this program has, and many counties tap into their services.
Okay, any questions from the members? Seeing none, thank you for the very good and enlightening presentation.
Thank you for your time.
Illuminating. Next we have Dale Wallstrom with the BioBusiness Alliance.
Mr. Chairman.
Could you give your name for the record and then your presentation, please?
My name is Dale Wallstrom. I am the president and CEO of the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota, and I do have a handout here, which I think you're handing out an old one. There's an update on the finances, so maybe you want to take this one instead and throw that other one away.
Mr. Walson, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 presenters. And we don't probably want to take a supper break, but we would like to have every one of the presenters be as concise and to the point as
yes,
they can be.
I will be.
Thank you.
Okay. My sole purpose for being here today is to try to clear up some confusion, because we received input from a number of sources that there's confusion around our funding and what we do. So I'm going to just be very brief in 5 minutes or less, explain what those two. One is we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We were spin out from Governor Pawlenty's original Bioscience Council with the intent of being an industry-led public-private partnership that's focused on growing jobs and the economic base in the state. As you all know, there are fundamentally, and I'm understating this to make it easier, but there's basically two approaches to do what we do. One is through large programs where you can put large investments into companies and organizations to get them off the ground. You've all heard of the programs at Ohio, California, North Carolina, and some of those have. When we were initially kicked off in 2004, that was not an option because Minnesota did not and still does not have the money for those kinds of programs. So we adopted a second approach, which is to provide fundamentally support mechanisms to help regions and companies take advantage of the resources that they have and get off the ground and become successful. We did that through a three-step approach. We developed an assessment and inventory of what is available around the state to work with for growth of job creation. We then developed a 20-year vision roadmap, which became known as Destination 2025. And what you see on the first slide is the implementation steps of that 20-year roadmap. The first On the right-hand side, you'll see, I should just clarify that. The way we implement Destination 2025 is through two basic things. One is we lead large projects that have, in some cases, regional impact, in some cases, statewide impact. And the second thing is we provide direct support to companies. And I might add, we are all out of the private sector. We all have experience at starting and running companies, so that is the a skill set that we bring to the process. So on that first slide that you see, on the right-hand side are projects that where you see a green dot. Those are projects that our organization is currently leading. Some are statewide in scope and cover all regions of the state. And then you'll see on the map on the left-hand side regional projects, or projects that are by geographic area. The yellow dots indicate projects that are either completed to the point where somebody else has taken them over, or projects that somebody else has started and we are supporting them. The second slide down is job creation. This is data that comes from the companies that we have supported, which there are 193 since we began the process in 2007. Of those 193 companies that we've supported at the end, because there's no good way to get data, the way we do it is we call them. Every December, we call every company and say, we ask them three questions. How many people have you hired? Second question is, how many people do you expect to hire in the next 3 years? And third question, how much capital have you been able to attract to your company? So the graph illustrates their answers, their responses. At the end of 1 year, they created 283 jobs. At the end of 2 years, it was 1,894. At the end of 3 years, it was 2,707. And they're predicting to create a total of those 193 companies are predicting to create a total of 4,893 jobs by the end of 2013. On the back side of that handout is on the third slide. As I mentioned, there's 193 companies so far. And as I said, they've collected $133 million in capital. I might add that as we break that down, then, the state investment so far since our formation is just under $4 million, slightly under $4 million. The per job created cost up to this point is about $3,500. Of that cost, about $1,500 per job comes from the state investment that you've made in our organization. The rest of it comes from grants from foundations. We have donations from academic centers, from private companies. We also have some reimbursement of expenses. As these companies become profitable, they pay us back. And then we have some of our services, which you've now started to charge for. So that is the mechanism that's just an update on what we do in the measures of what's been accomplished so far. The last slide is the reason that I'm here, because there's been a lot of confusion about how we're funded. If you start over in 2000, we were started in 2004 and 2005. All that money came from first-year money startup was from the private sector. And in 2006, 2007, is the first graph, you can see the amount. And we moved to the left, to the right. And in 2010, 2011, there was $1,710,000 that was in our total budget that came from the state, of which approximately $1 million, actually about $960,000 because of the unallocation, came from to the deed pass-through in a one-time of $710,000. So our total is $1,710,000. The three bars on the right represent our current understanding of the different proposals that are in the different bills for the Senate, the House, and the governor's proposal. So it's just to show you the degree reduction. If the governor's budget, where it's about a 58% reduction and so on. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I am done with my comments. I just wanted to point out where our funding levels have been and how we view them, where that money came from, and where the current proposals place us for next year. And I'll stop there, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions from the members? I think we have a partnership between the University of Minnesota and Mayo that is an incubator for jobs. And basically the typical business that comes out of here is like 10 to 12 to 15 to 20 people. It can be located in any one of your districts. Probably a better shot if you're in the University of Minnesota's area or Mayo's area. However, Dale's job was told to me as being one that takes these small companies that have been mentored by the University of Mayo and brings them out into the marketplace so they can become viable companies that support a workforce. And I think at one time or another, maybe you could say Medtronics or some of those companies started out exactly that way. We're very fortunate that we have two organizations like Mayo and the University in Minnesota. We certainly do not give the capital to this effort that other states do. However, I think there is 33 or 34,000 bioscience jobs in Minnesota today that are substantially above the average wage category. So it's something that we should give great attention to, in my opinion, because I think this is probably one of the best shots we have at growing jobs in Minnesota, in my opinion. And
Mr. Chair, I'll just jump on that, and I want to thank Mr. Walsham for the work that you've done. I've got a constituent that has been working with you and your organization. The contacts that you've given them, which I won't mention names of companies or contracts, but they've gone from, sitting around the table, drawing out ideas on a napkin, to now having a product and the relationships now that you've introduced to them to literally having the opportunity to change this sector of the healthcare market overnight. So without that relationship, without what you've done, it would have just been an idea. So this is something that I think that if we are going to be serious about competing with the other states, particularly the Ohios and North Carolinas that are out there, we've got to make an effort, because those states have done that. Many of them were 20 years behind that effort. But, I've seen the tangible fruits of the effort, so I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Wallstrom, I think I know the answer to this, but I want to make sure we get it on the record because I think it's important. Private funding, private sources of funding that you leverage, can you talk about that part of your story a little bit?
Yes, we have a minimum of a one-to-one match. You can tell by the ratio of the numbers, it costs us about $3,500 to create a job right now. Our history has been that. And the cost to the state is about $1,500. So it gives you, over the course of the years, it ranges a lot. And during the 2009 time frame, when the industry was in such crisis, it was harder to get donations and engagements. So that ratio went down that year. But generally, over the course of our existence, it's averaged out quite a bit better than one-to-one. And if we take donations, volunteer time, and I might I'll throw a pitch for that. We have over 60,000 hours of volunteer time up to this point of people. Many of them you can't hire. They're people in companies, people in universities, et cetera, who are donating their time to help these companies through their rough spots. I'm not sure if I answered your question, Mr. Chair.
I think you did a good job. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Yeah, Mr.
Chair, if I could digress for one moment, one minute or less. There was a question asked yesterday morning in the testimony about the Trade Department, that if it's acceptable to the chair, I'd like to comment on that.
Certainly.
Okay. There was a question asked yesterday, and I don't recall which senator or representative asked that question about what is the role of trade. I just want to let you know that we leverage the Trade Department a lot for our international work, because most of the countries that we do business with are not capitalistic countries. They're socialistic. They are monarchies. They are, whatever you name it. But the split between the separation that between the government and the private sector in those countries is not as clear as it is here. In fact, in many cases, you have to go through the government to get to the companies. So the Trade Department is a government representative for us that opens that door that is very difficult to get in, except on maybe a one-off basis if you don't have some kind of lever like that. So I just wanted to say, to answer that question that was asked, how is it used by different organizations? That's how we use it. It's been very effective for us in Japan, in China, in Saudi Arabia, and in Sweden so far. So thank you.
Thank you for that information. Appreciate it. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have Rick Cardenas and Christy Berwitz from Advocating Change Together.
Right in the corner, yep. I'm going to set up a little thing.
He is getting money from.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity once again to present our case. What we're doing is setting up the little handout that I gave you and show you what that looks like. Hold this up. The last time we met with Chair Gunther, he wanted to know, were there any jobs? Was there any movement in this? And I would like to point out one of the projects that we have at Advocating Change Together was this. Advocating Change Together is a leadership development program for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And Advocating Change Together is not necessarily an employment placement program, but we think that we're very much needed in a pre-employment program. And I think if you look at that handout that we have, and the red door is one of the examples of what some of the persons, man Mike from Southwest Minnesota was looking at in terms of what he would like his life to be. And with the red door, he's talking about having a good job, being myself, traveling the world, and an opportunity to work. And inside the door, he sees himself as an artist. The black door, no opportunities, unfair standards, feeling worthless, and some of the things that he has been in the past. And through our program, was able to see himself, as the green door indicates, someone who to get an education and to contribute and to be a taxpayer. So even though we don't do direct job placement, we prepare people to look at themselves as a valuable citizen and to make that move in the employment they may have, which may be a sheltered workshop or community-based employment. But it's something that numerous persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities need to gain some empowerment in order to move forward. And I'd like to have Christy, who's participated in our program. Give your name, Christy.
Christy, give your name, please.
I'm Chrissy.
You're speaking at Mike.
You went to the program. I really like the program. I have just been diagnosed with a disability, which I'm still trying to be comfortable with that. I didn't have no jobs. And when I did get a job, they made me clean right away. When I started going to the day program and they had me go to a human rights meeting, I got to learn, I got to speak up for myself and want to do more. Like, I want a cashier, I want to do the fitting room. And the human right lady, I forgot her name.
Corinne Corinne Vorbel.
Vorbel?
Yeah.
Okay. And she told me I have the right to speak for myself, telling me I have the opportunity to do what I want to do. They can't discriminate me for being slower or not. So I went back to work, and I was really scared. And a week later, my manager came up to me, and she told me she was a little sad because I didn't come to her at first. And she told me I do have the right to speak for myself, and I should have spoke for myself, but I just can't yet. And I got to the other week do a recording or the voicemail for our sales, which was really cool. So, but I really enjoy the meetings because they teach me a lot.
So Christy went through the program, and she gained that empowerment and asked a person very knowledgeable in human rights on what her rights might be. She's gone through many things like bullying in school, and her family has called her numerous names, and she's been able to go through one of our programs and develop the strength to ask for another job in the job that she already has, because she thought she was capable of doing that. Do you have any other parts to say? Okay. So we're in the competitive grant in the Senate, and of course, zeroed out in the House, but the governor has us in there, and we would certainly like to be included as not a pass-through, but, as a pass-through. That's where I'm going. I want to be a pass-through, as we were before. So thank you very much.
Do you have any questions from the members? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. I still don't know how many people that your organization got jobs for.
Got jobs. As I indicated, we're not a job placement. We are a job placement organization. We do not do job placement. We help people who may be working in sheltered workshops to move to another position, to become community, to try to get a job in community-based employment. There are, Christy says, she didn't know she had the right to move to another position to improve the position that she had within that organization that she's working for. She's community-based.
I think that's a wonderful thing that she learned. However, we do sponsor organizations like Macro that have shelter workshops and stuff like that that produce jobs that people can get a paycheck from, and that they can have the thrill and honor of working and getting a paycheck. And this is what the jobs committee is for, is to get people jobs instead of being an advocate for people's rights. I think you get money from the Health and Human Services Committee, is that correct?
Health and Human Services Committee, that we have.
You get funding from them also?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And that is for the organizing of self-advocacy organizations around the state. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Next, Ann Olson, Minnesota Workforce Council Association Director. Conference Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Ann Olson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. I can be very brief because most of the points that I was going to make, the Commissioner, Mr. Phillips from Deed, and Mr. Caligiuri from Deed made, in that the Minnesota Workforce Council Association represents the dislocated worker and youth program providers in the 16 workforce service areas across the state. And then we also represent the Workforce Investment Board members and the local elected officials that appoint them. I think just the point we wanted to make is we're concerned about, first, the Senate provision, that we're unsure whether the dislocated worker program would be included in the competitive grant program. Either one is problematic. The Senate language includes a cap of $1 million on grants, and the current funding for the dislocated worker program exceeds that. If each workforce service area were to compete on their own, one part of the state could receive a grant and the other part of the state might not. Keep in mind that employees across the entire state pay into this fund under the premise that if they have to lay off an employee, services will be available to those individuals under this program. So a competitive grant program across the 16 workforce service areas could create uneven funding for dislocated workers depending on where they live. We're also concerned about the timing of the grant process. Implementing a competitive grants process for the youth employment programs in particular is problematic because we're scheduled to start those programs statewide on July 1st. And so if we don't have a competitive grants process put in place by that time, we'd miss an entire summer of employment programs for youth. Finally, we're concerned the business people who are paying the workforce development fee are represented on the local workforce investment boards. As Mr. Caligiuri mentioned, 51% of the folks who sit on the local workforce boards do represent private industry, and they are supportive of paying this fee when they know that it's going toward serving dislocated workers and employment and training programs that the fund was intended for, as Mr. Caligiuri kind of walked through yesterday what the original intent of the fund is. And we're concerned that if this is opened up to a lot of different grant processes, that employer support for the fund might wane. We understand that accountability is important, but the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, which some of this language is based on, did not include the Minnesota Youth Program nor the Dislocated Worker Program in their list of programs that might benefit from a competitive grants process. In fact, they specifically noted that the Dislocated Worker Program was cost-effective and was serving people well. So our workforce boards work really diligently to oversee these funds, and we're hopeful that you could reconsider whether the youth program and the dislocated worker program would be part of the competitive process. So if you have any questions about once the funds leave the department, they are allocated out to the local 16 workforce service areas based on an allocation that takes into account need of each of those areas. We could be happy to answer questions about how that works at the local level.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation. Are you in for the competition for grants program? Is that what you are in?
Well, currently, Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Youth Program is in the House and Senate proposal to be competitive. As you're aware, in the Senate, it would be immediately. In the House proposal, it would be delayed by 1 year. We're really unclear with the way the language is written whether or not the current dislocated worker program would be part of the competitive grants process or not, because it's funded out of the Workforce Development Fund. So the Senate language is really unclear to us at this point.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly have it cleared up before long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from members for Ms. Olson? Thank you very much. Next, we have Deb Wilkin Costello, President of Women Venture. I hope I said that name just the way
you did. Deb Wilkins Costello, President of Women Venture.
Very well.
We'll be short and clear. I'm the president of Women Venture. I've been there about 14 months. We are an organization that has been around since 1978. This year, we will exceed serving 100,000 mostly women. We serve about 12% men at Women Venture. We do a couple of core things. We're a small business. We make loans to small businesses created or needing re-energizing for women, for their businesses. We have been receiving deed funding for the last 16 years. The last 10 years, we've been receiving $200,000 on an annual basis. In the House, there is a recommended decrease to our funding by $50,000 a year. So that would be, when we add federal funding matching dollars to that, about a $67,500 loss to Women Venture. On the Senate House, we are being included in the competitive process, and I want to speak to that very, very briefly. I personally, and we at Women Venture, support the competitive process. We do not, however, support the competitive process being implemented this fiscal year for fiscal 12. Our concern is that we're pretty confident, no disrespect to Deed, but it's very difficult to implement a competitive process in this short notice. We're very, very concerned about that. Our fiscal year starts July 1. I was just in a finance committee meeting today with my staff saying that our board of directors will not approve any type of budget without any sense of any likelihood of receiving funds. So for us to enter into competitive process for July 1, fiscal year 12, we will automatically need to decrease our staff at Women Venture, which means less loans that we'll be able to make. We won't have the human resources to do that. In the last 3 years, we made 165 loans to new businesses and 180 loans to existing businesses that needed expansion or a shot in the arm. We have created over 780 jobs. If we lose that funding now as of July 1, there's no way that my board of directors would approve an operating budget without any sense, and so immediately our program changes. If we need to go on with the decrease that the House is recommending, we at least can go in with a plan that we know we can continue to serve a certain amount of clients, either to help them get better jobs, higher-paying jobs, or help businesses with getting loans.
Diane. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Diane Patterson, and I am the Business Development Director at Women Venture. Just to give you an idea of the impact that we have on the community, and we serve the 15-county area around the metropolitan area. In 2010 alone, we made $473,000 in loans. Access to capital, as we all know, is critical to starting and sustaining businesses. But what we also do, in addition to making those loans, is we offer unlimited business consulting services to these loan clients so that we can ensure their success. And to that point, when we are typically lending to unbankable clients who have faced economic challenges, maybe their credit score is not at a level of a traditional lending institution, or they're lacking the collateral that the banks are requiring with their toughened underwriting criteria. So these are unbankable clients, and yet our loan default rate is only 4%. In 2009 alone, we had a 0% default rate. So we're not just giving out money to start and grow small businesses and saying good luck. In fact, with those low default rates, we are showing that we're doing a really darn good job, and these are creating jobs. In 2010, 245 jobs were created. We're estimating that that brought in just shy of $3 million in new salaried income, which generates approximately $200,000 to the state of Minnesota in income tax alone. So these are great impacts that we are bringing to the community at a time when we have record unemployment rates and record foreclosures, and SBA alone now is in double-digit default rate. The federal government recently published that the national default rate for the Small Business Administration is 12%, and Women Ventures is 4%. Thank you.
So in closing, again, we ask that the competitive process be delayed at least one fiscal year so that organizations like us can get involved in a thoughtful process so that we can be responsible to our clients to, in terms of planning in the future as well.
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, both of you, to Women Venture for the good example and the good story that you bring to us. Mr. Chair, it just reminds me that as we talk about this, there's a transition and a timing issue, and I'm going to set that aside. This committee is going to have to deal with that. But when I hear good numbers and good history and a good story when it comes to jobs, it reminds me of some of the kind of public policy we had earlier in the Senate, which was good programs like this in a competitive situation could really win.
Mm-hmm.
Could really win more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I look at, so your history with at least the state is 10 years, At $200,000 a year?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I guess we've, I guess you can say there was a benefit in consistency there, but it strikes me that if you can come to this kind of a table with strong, a good story, measurable, with benchmarks, that this kind of a program, Mr. Chair, could win. If winning is always more money, and I know we can't define things that way anymore, but if winning is, in this case, kind of being an all-star in this competitive grant process, I think this could be one of those examples. So thanks for letting me pontificate a little.
Just out of curiosity, do you leverage money besides the state money? How much do you get from the private sector? And
how much do we get from the private sector?
Yes.
Do you want to speak to the SBA and see? Well, from the federal government, we get almost dollar for dollar match to the state funding. And then from foundations and individuals and corporate, that's running at about.
Those are funds that we do raise for class, our coursework. Mm-hmm. And, I'm going to take a guess at about 10% at the max.
10%.
Right.
And those are typically restricted for scholarships so that our clients can take our courses and utilize our business consulting services at a drastically discounted price, typically 90%.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, also, the people that you helped in the past ever come up and say, thank you very much. We would like to contribute so much money to help the next person come around, the next woman venture job.
It's just a great idea. We haven't done a great job of that. Since I've been there in the last year, we're starting to really reach out to that particular group. But we have not kept great records of those people over the 30 years. And so it feels like that's a new initiative for us, whereas I wished I could say to you it's something we've been doing for a long time.
Maybe
but absolutely, those are the people that we'll reach
you
to.
Tell us.
Absolutely, thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job. Lee Antel, American Indian OIC. Welcome to the committee. Would you give your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Lee Antel. I'm the president and CEO of the American Indian OIC, a position that I've held for the past 12 years. And the first thing I want to share with the committee is that we understand that the budget is tough, money is tight, and we all have to share the pain. We understand that. And we think that in our program, the House version of reducing our budget by $550,000 for the biennium, while we're not overjoyed with that particular action, it's something that we can live with. We can tighten our belt. We can make things work. We have trouble with the block grants on the Senate side. And the reason for that is, and it was addressed by the last speaker, is the timing of it. Back in the 70s, I had the opportunity to work for the U.S. Department of Education. And when you were going to implement a new program, it took you at least 6 months to roll it out before the grantees would ever see any money. So do we want to go into a fiscal year with 16 well-known, well-reputed organizations without them having any knowledge of if they're going to have any money for the next 6 months? I don't think that's a good thing to do. Also, there's a $1 million cap per organization on the Senate side, that would cut all of the OICs, of which there are five, by another $750,000. That would be very harmful to the OICs. There are several OICs which are a little larger, which maybe could suffer through that kind of a cut, but there are a couple small OICs that are smaller, and that would be devastating if that were to be implemented. As far as entering competition with other organizations, the OICs are not, we're not hesitant to do that. We have a good track record. We've met the goals that have been set to us by DEED. We provide DEED with quarterly reports of all of our actions, all of our activities. Closer monitoring, scrutiny by DEED, we would welcome. We certainly wouldn't have any fear of that. So we are here to let you know that we can live with the House version, but the Senate version would be very difficult for us. And another reason why we're not afraid of the competition, and so I don't want to make it sound like we don't want it because we don't think we could compete. About a year and a half ago, we were awarded a very large grant from the U.S. Department of Labor. And we recently had an evaluation team come to our site. And a week and a half ago, we received a site visit by the U.S. Department Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis, came to the American Indian OIC because of the best practices that were reported by the evaluation team. So competition in and of itself isn't something that we're afraid of. But the timing of it, as I look through the materials, there's 12 different programs that would have to have rules and regulations created. And the main issue on the competitive grants is who's going to evaluate those grants? The way it's worked up until now, at least since we've been getting the pass-through grants since 1982, this body basically evaluated who got the money. And every year I would come up here before the House Committee on Jobs and the Senate Committee on Jobs, and the legislature would make the decision. Who's going to make the decisions now in the competitive process for 12 different programs? Is it going to be the legislature, or is it going to be a handful of citizens who may or may not know anything about poverty, about minorities, about disparities, about job training, and so forth? Who are those people going to be that are going to make those decisions? I prefer this body to make those kinds of decisions, because the regular citizens plucked from the streets of Minnesota, I don't care what job they have, aren't well-versed in the problems and the situations that we face in the community, in the minority community, in the poverty community, on a day-by-day basis. They simply don't have that information. And I don't think the common citizen without that kind of information should be making decisions on these proposals. I would rather see this group do it. Okay. So that's essentially the message that we have. We can live with the House cuts, although not as much as we would like, of course, and we would hope that you would not implement the Senate version. Thank you.
Okay, any questions from the members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. Appreciate it. I got it. And next we have Kathy Lawrence, Twin Cities Rise.
Not Kathy, but
you'll do.
I'll do.
Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Art Berman. This is Kathy.
Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you.
I am the president and CEO of Twin Cities Rise, and Kathy is our development director. I'd like to just share perspective today on the current process and the proposals. Twin Cities Rise, as you all know, I hope that we are a work skills training program and job placement program. We work with the poorest adults in our communities. We've been around for about 20 years and have a strong record of success. The current status of our program in terms of this body is we are looking at a cut in the House version of a little less than 10%. And I would like to talk a little bit, give you a perspective on the Senate proposal, because I know that's the subject of much discussion today and yesterday. Twin Cities Rise is very supportive of the principles of transparency and accountability. Those of you who know us know that. We currently have a pay-for-performance model, which is an accountable model. This is how we are funded and have been funded for many years by the state. The way it works is we have agreed with the state how to define success, which is placing someone very poor, chronically unemployed, in a full-time living wage job after having gone through a program that can last up to 18 months, and having them succeed in that job and keep that job for at least a year. And in the case of our graduates, a vast majority have long-term job retention. Senator Michelle, you asked Commissioner Phillips yesterday whether DEED knows what the outcomes are for the programs that it funds today. The answer in the case of Twin Cities Rise is yes. For everyone we work with and succeed with, we know exactly how much their income changed from the start of the program to the end, and typically that is more than $20,000. We know what their job retention level is. After a year, it's over 80% consistently. After 2 years, it's over 70%. We know what the impact is on recidivism. We serve a very high percentage of ex-offenders, and this is our mission, important part of our mission, and we track it. So we are all about outcomes, transparency, and accountability. So, again, we support the principles underlying the Senate proposal. I would just like to share a perspective in the spirit of concerns about it, and I'm going to echo to some extent what you've already heard. But first, let me talk about pay for performance for a moment. It's not clear to me, and I'm not sure if this has been addressed yet at the DEED level, how the pay for performance model that we currently work under, that presumably in the future in the status quo environment we would continue to be funded, how that would be treated in a competitive process. Would the playing field be leveled and no one would be on pay for performance, which I think would be a mistake because something would be lost. Pay for performance is a very effective mechanism to hold us accountable and to share with you a guarantee to you and state taxpayers a high return. Or do you put everybody in a pay-for-performance to provide even more transparency? I think it's an interesting question and one that I would ask you to think about in the process if we go down that route in the process of implementation. That, by the way, would be an outcome that we would welcome. We think it's important to be accountable to you and to the state taxpayers, and we would like other programs to be held to that standard. The second issue I'd like to address relates to potential for operational disruption, and this is the issue about timing and transition. In the short term, it's a concern about just the timing. This would be a big change, and I think it would require some thoughtfulness about how to implement it to minimize disruption on programs such as ours and the ones you're hearing from today. Longer term, we don't know what the parameters of the program are, so we can't really comment on how this would affect our ability to plan effectively. But it's just something that, as a program leader, I have to think about because I'm managing resources. And then the last thing I would say is, always go back to the people we serve, and the people we serve are the chronically unemployed with very high barriers to employment success. So program disruption is a concern. It affects in a very, very real way the lives of people I deal with every day. So I just would like to be mindful of that. And so I would just like to wrap it up and say I think accountability and transparency is a great thing. We support that. We just want to, and we will support whatever process is decided upon, and we would work closely with our DEED colleagues to help them implement whatever process is decided upon and make it work as well as possible for all of you. We just ask that it be thoughtful and not and make sure, to the extent we can, to minimize any unintended consequences of what is otherwise a very good idea.
Okay, any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Do you want to say anything?
Nope, just available for questions.
I appreciate that very much. And it looks like we're all fairly familiar with your program. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
And next, Sam Walsif, LifeTrack Resources, or Trixie Goldberg, or both.
Mr. Chairman, Trixie Goldberg, President of LifeTrack, is here, so I'll let her testify and I'll stand.
I will enjoy that.
Good. Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. And I will echo Trixie Goldberg, President with LifeTrack Resources.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm just here to echo some of the concerns that you've heard. I hope by now you're familiar with the collaboration between DEED and LifeTrack Resources, which uniquely focuses on employment services for legal immigrants and refugees. And the unique piece for this collaboration is the collaboration was created in 1997 to create efficiency through collaboration. And over the history of that partnership, we have created increased efficiency, moving from an average cost per job placement of around $2,000 to now driving the average cost per placement to around $1,200 per placement, and serving over 4,000 refugees and immigrants across the metro and southern Minnesota, serving thousands of employers like J.B. Swift, Select Foods, Quality Pork, Doubletree Hotels, Corporate Management Group, Bix Produce, and National Bakery. So the concerns over taking a collaborative model, which, again, shared many of the same goals of today, efficiency, effectiveness, clear documentation of results, and modifying it now to fit within a competitive grant, will take some significant conversation and discussion. The collaboration has grown, as I mentioned, to really be a reliable source for legal immigrants and refugees for a number of our employers. And our phone is starting to ring again. So my concern about messing with this with a program that really has worked and been reliable at this time is really critical. We've also been very successful through the collaborative model in leveraging significant federal dollars, leveraging significant private dollars. So really understanding how do we keep those moving parts moving and not having a delay in services at this critical time is really essential. And DEED has worked with us each year of our partnership and our contract in making sure that there are clearly established goals and documentation going back every year through 1997. So I will not share all those documents with you, but I, to again, remind you that those are available. So again, I simply close by being open for questions and asking, as others have, that any modifications in the awarding or contracting process be done in a very thoughtful way that consider both the strategic outcomes and the employer's needs across Minnesota. Thank you.
Any questions from the members? How many people did you place last year?
In 2010, we placed 232 individuals and exceeding the established goal within the DEED contract.
Okay. Thank you very much. We know your outcome. Next, see where I'm at here. We have Stoney Hayes in behalf of the Minnesota Alliance for Boys and Girls Club. Could you give your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Stoney Hayes. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Stoney Hayes with the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Twin Cities. I'm here today as a representative of Minnesota State Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs. As a workforce development grant lead agency, I want to thank you, and I'd like to share some concerns proposed in terms of the movement of the workforce development grant to a competitive process. As you know, the Minnesota State Alliance has 52 Boys and Girls Clubs across the state, serving 57,000 youth. Since 2006, our evidence-based programs have been successful in serving more than 29,000 youth and preparing them for the workforce. We have several concerns that have been shared with you today about moving it to a competitive process. Number one, if the goal is transparency, we have some concerns whether this can be achieved through this path. We have been a DEED partner for about 6 years now and believe that reporting measures required by DEED have been modified throughout this time and reflect the value of our partnership. We have brought two samples of various reporting that have been provided for DEED over the years. Secondly, every 2 years we come before the legislature to justify the state's continued partnership with the Boys and Girls. Clubs have repeatedly been open and honest in their reporting, and this can be confirmed by DEED. And while the bill does propose that the job skills partner report back to the legislature summary data on its grant recipients, this is hardly the quarterly reporting formally required by DEED, nor the in-depth scrutiny that grant recipients go through every 2 years in front of this legislative group. Additionally, our clubs still internally report quarterly to the Alliance. Not only do they report quarterly, but they plan and evaluate each of their programs quarterly using written objectives and program plans developed by Boys and Girls Clubs of America's evidence-based programs. While the details of the competitive grant process has not been fully revealed, we worry about the effects it could have on the long-term vision of the state. Youth job training is not something that just happens in a funding cycle. Training youth for the workforce requires a long-term commitment and a strong relationship with its stakeholders. We believe that this is why the legislative direction is needed in this area. Past legislators have recognized this long-term value of this work and look for funding mechanisms to achieve its results into the future. Moving this funding to a competitive grant cycle may not acknowledge these long-standing relationships and cause a disruption in already successful job training efforts around the state. The timeline outlined in the proposed language seems to be unrealistic. There's very little lead time for both the DEED and the grant recipients to make plans for possible funding elimination, and if legislation were to become law today, we would barely have 2 months to create an RFP process, to post the RFPs, and to choose the recipients and get the funding out the door. Finally, the proposed pool for competition, while still not fully defined, could be problematic. With so many deserving programs with greatly varied missions vying for the pot of money with vague goals, there seems to be many unanswered questions about how the dollars would be directed and for what defined purpose. Mr. Chair, members, we recognize the difficult budget pressures you face and your desire to increase accountability and transparency in results. We believe that your desired results could possibly be accomplished by transforming the standards and measurements by which evaluate these programs as a better way to support Minnesota's priority of job creation and training in the most effective way possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the members? I have several. Just out of curiosity, do you get federal funding?
Yes, we do, Chair.
How much?
The Boys and Girls Club State Alliance, there's 12 different organizations in the state. Mm-hmm. In the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Twin Cities, we receive about $160,000 in federal fund.
$160,000.
Mm-hmm.
Is Boys and Girls Club the biggest youth job program in the state? Or is Minnesota Youth bigger than Boys and Girls Club or what?
Well, you know, the Boys and Girls Clubs, we have five core programs that we provide programming in. It's a year-round program. I think we have, you know, a more variety of program than just a specific job readiness program. We're working with youth between the ages of 6 and 18 in the areas of education and career development, character and leadership development, health and life skills, the arts, and sports, fitness, and recreation. So the jobs portion, the job prep portion, comes out of our education and career development area of our programs.
Very often, you are the first line on any young person's resume. Do you give them a certificate of achievement when they're finished every year that they operate?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
It's a very important line, by the way.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and it starts at the age of 6, working with our young people and teaching them how to set goals. We take for granted as successful folks of how to set goals, but both short-term and long-term goals. Then we begin to work with those young people in making healthy life choices to be healthy and be a healthy workforce. Then they transition into a career development program called Career Launch, which is an evidence-based program developed by Boys and Girls Clubs of America in doing job exploration with our young people between the ages 11 and 15. And then we have a job-ready program that certifies them to be job-ready. And honestly, Chair, 6 years ago when we first received funding for this, our teenagers used to come to me and say, you know, I don't really need to be job-ready to get a job. You know, there were so many jobs that you just didn't have to do that. Today, those same teenagers are really appreciative of the fact that they're prepared for a job, they have that certified stamp to go out and get a job, and we have our staff who help transition them from the classroom to a job as well.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate it. Next, we have Brian Kao, Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and Jean Lee. Welcome to the committee. Would you give your name for the record, please?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee. I'm President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and head APAC, the Asian Pacific American Consortium. Brian thought that the testimony would be continued until tomorrow, so some of the other councils who were here work to that understanding, so we haven't been able to round them back up. However, we do have representation from the Council on Black Minnesotans. So
the Chiquina Latinos were here a minute ago.
Right, and yes. Right, we were still looking for them.
Anyway, go ahead with your testimony.
Yes. So if it's all right with the committee, perhaps, you know, them not being here, they could submit testimony by letter.
That would be very good. We'd like that. We have several to pass out already.
Thank you. As far as APAC, the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, this is a group that includes over 15 unfunded Asian Pacific service providers. It also includes realtors, lenders, developers, and others in the housing industry. To cover all areas of housing and development. Now, some of the other councils could testify as far as, you know, their communities, too. Now, our APAC helps all Minnesotans. We serve the low-income, disadvantaged, homeless, and other populations that Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has a mission to serve. They also have expertise in the cultural competence services and service the community. the API community. And we also have a new project as far as targeting about 400,000 other Minnesotans, specific Minnesotans. And if it please the committee, I have some handouts here as far as the testimony, because I know your time is short, and to kind of go over briefly what this is. Yeah.
We'll get somebody pass them here.
We're basically talking about service providers that have not been funded by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and are not HUD approved, because HUD requires 1 year as a recognized counseling agency first, and recognition of being funded by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. There was a law change that affected those who have not yet been HUD approved as far as them being able to become HUD approved. Being a HUD approved agency gets federal funds for the agency as far as staff, program training, and other certifications and licensing, travel, and other federal funds whereby they can become self-sustaining. So most of the agencies currently with Minnesota Housing are already HUD approved. And according to a Minnesota law, or actually there's about three laws that were passed in the two-year interim that I was aware of it, they basically made it more difficult for the smaller agencies as far as becoming what was termed counseling agencies and also becoming HUD approved. We have one member of our organization that has 75 years experience in housing, over 40 years providing housing, and 30 years providing support services, also having various licenses and certifications, and having veterans that serve veteran services. However, they weren't grandfathered in as far as certifications, so basically they'll be repeating courses where they already know the material. And there's some barriers as far as the process of becoming certified, and as I said again, the law regarding being considered a counseling agency for HUD approval. All of our service provider members do what housing counselors are supposed to be doing as part of their comprehensive social services. However, they need the funds for certifications and for program and staff requirements and building capacity. All provider members have provided services to veterans. We had one who was supposed to testify today. We have one member who's also still helping World War II veterans. And the members provide with other housing employment needs. Now, I wanted to skip my background, except just to say that I am a certified housing counselor and educator. I had to travel to NeighborWorks America for their courses in D.C. It was basically $5,000 per course for me because I wasn't able to access those courses here in Minnesota. However, even for the 2 years as far as being a counselor, it still did not qualify me as far as being considered a housing counseling agency, even though we've been doing it for over 30 years. So there are barriers in legislation that have to be fixed, and I testified to that before. And as far as NeighborWorks America, I did testify before that they were created out of Congress to help provide the education and training that is the standard nationally. And so all the other housing certifying entities here do have that base program. The reason I mentioned that is because through Minnesota Housing, there's some issues as far as who you are certified by and whether you have to retake courses, even though you were certified by one certifying entity, retaking it from another. And this also applies to consumers who have to retake classes that a counselor would give. So if I'm not so-called the right certified counseling agency or properly have the proper certification, even though it was with NeighborWorks, then technically my clients would have to retake courses. And, of course, why would they come to me? And also, why would I take some of these other courses? So there are issues there which I mentioned for the past 2 years that still have to be worked out. The testimony was heard last year in Commerce Committee, in Judiciary, and in Jobs and Economic as far as some of the problems. The problems we had hoped would be resolved. We've been to the table with various languages, you know, to try and rectify some of the problems. And so we're still trying to work with the department as far as coming up with language that will fix the problems to the barriers that we have. In particular, as I was talking about the counselors, this related to the HECAT funds. However, we also found out that legislatively, under Minnesota Housing, there's an issue as far as priority of funding to agencies and why a number of the agencies in this consortium have continually had problems even before we started the consortium in getting funds, where the priority had been towards the larger agencies versus the smaller agencies who needed the funds to build capacity to get their counselor certified and to become HUD approved. With the proper, like I said, removing the barriers with just the HECAT funds alone, and we're talking that there may be barriers to the other types of funding too that we're addressing as far as the grant processes. With the HECAT funds alone, we can create 24 to 30 jobs, leverage it into other funds and revenue. And we have one proposal in this other area of funding as far as creating 1,500 jobs, 700 housing units with related jobs and income, sales revenue, new businesses, and other aspects of creating jobs and doing economic development. However, as I've testified before the different committee processes, as it was moving along, we still need the right language as far as fixing the barriers that are both legislatively and in the grant process. And this has been ongoing for some time. And I'm hoping that there'll be some collaboration as far as being able to fix the problem.
Ms. Lee, we have a question here.
Yes.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lee, you said you were representing the consortium. Is that part of the Asian Pacific Council?
The consortium is a group of, like I said, service providers that service the Asian community. They're run and were created by the Asian Pacific community, but they also include realtors, lenders, and others in the housing industry as far as being part of the consortium. They are like a separate entity from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. The Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans is a state agency.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lee, does the Asian Pacific Council support what you're bringing forward?
We've talked about it, and on the issues they were going to testify as to the problems that the legislation that the API organizations and others have. And to that end, they do support the funding. They have always supported funding the Asian organizations. They have supported the same service providers in the past on other types of funding. And, in fact, there was a letter from them where we tried to get federal funding, but we didn't know that not getting state funding was a barrier and not being HUD approved was a barrier. So we didn't get the federal funds, and we did have a letter of support from them for the funds.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Count, welcome to our committee. Would you give your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Roger Banks.
Roger Banks, great.
Right, and I'm the research and policy analyst for the Council on Black Minnesotans.
Wonderful.
I'm sitting here instead of Lester Collins, our executive director.
Well, thank you. For
we do have some concerns. The council was created in 1980 for the purpose of advising the governor, his administration, the legislature, et cetera, and policymakers across the board on issues impacting African and African Americans. And one of the major issues that we have has to do with our major theme going for the last several years, and that has to do with the promotion of equity and accountability. You've mentioned a transparency and accountability. Our experience with that is that your transparency historically has not been equitable. That what we find in essence is that the manner in which RFPs are structured have a tendency historically to exclude strong, capable, long-lasting black organizations in this state as far as, you know, housing or health or, you know, juvenile justice. You know, what I'm saying in essence is that we take the big picture. And before we can really look at resolving issues that we're faced with today, there has to be some kind of major changes in terms of the way that information is gathered, reported, and collected, and the particular constructs used for this particular purpose. What you find in the area of housing, for example, is that they use one construct. That is the construct of having populations of color defined as black, Chicano, American Indian, Latino, etc. What has happened in essence is that that is an antiquated process, and that what is needed in essence is an integrated information system that allows us to differentiate between what is being done that will allow us to be accountable. Our issue is accountable to who? To whom? And so what I'm saying in essence is that we will be submitting a written response to this issue because I'm sure not qualified to do that at this point in time. But I just wanted to bring to your attention the need for some specific kinds of changes and the need for designing, for example, RFPs that aren't exclusive, that don't actually eliminate the prospects of populations of color and American Indian agencies participating in the RFP process. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We look forward to the letter. And thank you for your presentation. Representative Sanders got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if you could expound on some specifics on how our RFPs or government RFPs exclude, I think in your words, strong, capable businesses that belong to your organization or have members. Right. Because I certainly know that, you know, there are a lot of RFPs floating out there. We certainly don't want to do that. So I'd be interested to hear how specifically that's happened so we don't repeat those types of
Well, thank you very much for that particular question because it is a very critical part of what we have been facing over the last several years in the state of Minnesota. The need and what we have is a situation where, like, for example, with the Department of Health and Human Services, that in their alcohol abuse program, they design a RFP that does not take into consideration the needs of the populations to be served. And these, I mean, are funds that are supposed to go to populations of color and, you know, minority populations of American Indians. And they don't. And as a result, there has been this what is felt to be a disingenuous effort on the part of the state to try to incorporate them. I sit on a whole range of various committees, one of which is the DHS Alcohol Evaluation Unit and the RFPs for Populations of Colored American Indians. And based on that type of experience, I've seen that a lot of people, a lot of organizations that fit into those categories resent or will not participate. They will not submit proposals because they think it is a sham. They think that it's already a foregone conclusion, as it has been historically, that certain groups will get certain monies and that's it.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
We want to thank you for your letter, too. We will certainly read that.
Mr. Chair, if I might add to that in answer, and Representative Sanders, in answer to that, as it relates to housing under Minnesota Section 462A.029 Subdivision 3, it talks about eligibility for the funds, and in Statute 462A.209 Subdivision 5, it talks about the selection criteria, and this is where there's a disparities exist as far as being able to fund the organizations that serve the communities in need, that they themselves need to be funded in order to do that, versus the larger organizations who already have received prior funding. They're self-sustainable by an existing system as far as being already HUD funded or already having the clientele to be self-sufficient and so forth. So this is where the disparities, and that's also an area that needs to be fixing. But if I might also
you
give
this...
You
say they are HUD pass-through through the state or HUD funded? HUD's a federal agency.
Right. The funds that NeighborWorks America gives to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and that HUD gives to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, I'm not sure how it's all divided, but the federal funds also go through that route and they get dispersed. And so, again, if they're looking at criteria as to how to give to the different organizations as far as being a pass-through, these criteria are creating disparities, and they're in existing law, and that's what also needs to be fixed as far as making it or balancing the playing field, so to speak. But if I also...
If you can, pardon me?
And there's one other thing, but I only have one copy, so I'll give it to Senator...
Why don't you give it to Dan, and he will make sure Minnesota Housing Finance works on getting you answers.
Okay. I mean, this is an example as far as if... Say Senator Michelle's friend was in need of services, how there's a system that excludes certified counselors and agencies from the public notifying them. So this is an example of as far as the existing process, and if he were to look for help, and according to law it says how he's supposed to look for help, et cetera, that he wouldn't necessarily find the kinds of help that he would need.
Senator Michelle's purposes, and for years, if you could put them in writing, we'll have Minnesota Housing Finance get you the answers.
Great.
It's the best I can do.
You're my favorite.
I am. Very much so. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it very much, and I'll look forward to working with Representative Mulry this summer. He told me he's got a hold of me.
Okay, great.
All right, thank you.
And thank you very much.
And next we have Hector Garcia. Is he still here?
I don't know if he's here.
The councils were together.
Well, he's not here now. So maybe he's talked to me before. Certainly he'll come see me.
Hector and Brian.
And then we have... I don't know.
He was also with our group.
He was. Okay. Is he here now?
He's got tomorrow.
Okay, then the last person we have, finally hit the last, is Mike Riley, comments on the Combative Sports Commission. And we're looking forward to those comments. We're almost there, guys. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael Riley, and thank you, chairs, senators, representatives, for hearing me today. I've been waiting for a long time to get an opportunity to speak in front of this committee, and so when I got a call at 3:35 today and asked me if I'd like to, I came on my motorcycle, and hopefully I won't be driving home in the rain. I've been involved in combat sports for pretty much my entire life. At least 30 years in full contact sports, including wrestling, boxing, Muay Thai, Jiu-Jitsu, Judo, and mixed martial arts. I have been an athlete, a coach, a trainer, cut man, referee, judge, promoter. I've done everything in the sport that you can imagine with the exception of being a ring card girl, but I dare to dream. Most importantly, however, I am a taxpayer in the state of Minnesota. The aptly named Minnesota Combative Sports Commission is the latest manifestation of the Boxing Commission that oversaw boxing in the sport on again and off again for decades. There's been a number of times where it's been defunct because it's never been able to sustain itself. It's never been able to fund itself. Currently, boxing and mixed martial arts are the only sports in the state that are overseen by a state commission. Football, hockey, they just started a new ladies football league, roller derby, any contact sport you can imagine has no oversight on it whatsoever. There's no state oversight because all of these sports have self-private commissions and are able to self-govern themselves. Mixed martial arts was such a sport for over 500 events in the state of Minnesota until the Boxing Commission was formed and they realized that the Boxing Commission was completely incapable of funding itself. The boxing in the state of Minnesota, we're not a big boxing state, so we're going to hold maybe four or five boxing events. That's not going to cover somebody's $65,000 salary. So they decided to oversee mixed martial arts, even though there was absolutely no reason for them to oversee our sport. The commission has no experience in the sport. And unfortunately, the commission really has been a beautiful example of waste, bias, nepotism, malfeasance, and in the end, it's been a complete failure. And I sat down and I had 36 examples I can give you of this, but I know that's, to be honest, that's really not important. What is important is that this commission is costing the state a minimum of $80,000. Now, they have one full-time employee who gets $65,000. They have a part-time, they have another full-time employee who gets $35,000. I don't have any full-time state employees that don't get benefits, but they don't report that as counting against their budget. They're supposed to be self-funding, but they've been absolutely incapable of doing so, and roughly they cost the state about $7,000 a month. So even if they were perfect in doing their job, there's absolutely no reason for the state to be funding a commission like this. Now, I didn't expect to, but I've got to listen to about 3 hours of testimony today. That's absolutely amazing. Some of the things that people are doing in this room, some of the things they're doing in their community, you know, as a taxpayer, a lot of times I gripe about where state money is going. In fact, me probably more than anybody else. That's pretty much a full-time hobby, is griping about how money gets wasted. What I've been hearing today, I mean, some of the things that people have been doing, this lady's testimony really moved me over here, the testimony from this group, I mean, it's phenomenal what some of this money that the state can spend can do, and I can really see the value of it. But there's no value in this commission. So I have kind of a gift for the commission, for this committee today. Because everybody is saying, don't cut our budget, give us more money, don't cut our budget, don't cut our budget. I'm pleading on behalf of athletes, coaches, and promoters, cut this budget. Take that money and spend it on anything. Put it down on one hand of blackjack if you want. It will be better spent than continuing to pour it down the rat hole that is this commission. Our sport is capable of self-governing. Cities have oversight on events that take place in their cities. And if a city doesn't want it, honestly, and there's four cities in the state that have banned it, God bless them. They have the right to do that. And if they want to ban, if they don't want the sport, they can say we don't want it. The sport is capable of defending itself and is capable of regulating itself. And we do not need to continue to waste taxpayers' dollars on this commission. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Riley, believe it or not, your wish is already taken care of.
Sweet.
We are not funding the Combative Sports Commission with anything but fees for the combatants. And that is where the funding is coming from. And can you answer one question for me?
Yes.
Can you have a sanctioned fight without having a thing like a Combative Sports Commission?
Yes. Every sport actually has sanctioning bodies. So, for example, judo, it's the USJA. There's a number of states in Florida, Missouri, they actually use private sanctioning bodies for mixed martial arts. They actually have a commission in Missouri, but they do absolutely nothing except for to make sure the private sanctioning body follows all the health and safety regulations that they need. I understand the thing about the fees, except for that we have a $65,000 salary, we have a $35,000 salary. Every time they do a show, they have inspectors they have to pay. Overall, the actual cost of running this commission is about $170,000 to $180,000. There's no way that the fees are going to cover that gap. There's absolutely no way they're going to do it. Unless the only way they can do it is if they charge roughly, I know they're trying to raise the fees right now to about four times what they were. They're going to have to raise them to about 10 times what they are, and they're still probably going to come up short. We simply can't afford these two state employees. I mean, I think if you cut that, you'd be cutting $100,000. Then the state commission would have a fighting chance. But there's no way we can afford these two employees. And quite frankly, this is two employees. I know that one of the groups was talking about if their funding gets cut, they're going to lose some interpreters. I'm sorry. I think the interpreters are more important than these employees overseeing the commission. We did this for 500 shows without any state oversight. And people came and told a lot of horror stories, but there was absolutely no evidence of any of these horror stories taking place. You know, there was no life-altering injuries. There was no riots. There was no, you know, any of the shenanigans were pretty much handled by the community. And like I said, every sport governs themselves this way.
For example, this goes from 150 to 500.
Okay. The fees are covering it. There's no state money into it. What do you have that prevents David beating the tar out of Goliath? No, Goliath beating the tar out of David. What do we have to prevent that from happening? Do we have any sanctioning board without the Combative Sports Commission? Because I remember when we formed the Combative Sports Commission, which was not one of my finest days, by the way. It has been a nightmare ever since I had anything to do with it, and that was way, way long ago. 17 years ago or so. It has been a nightmare. We had it. We had Iowa take care of it. Iowa backed out.
Right.
They said that there is some fiduciary responsibility the state has if we have somebody that fights that is a tremendous mismatch and somebody gets killed.
Right.
There is no, in boxing, there has to be sanctioned fights. In mixed martial arts, there doesn't, I guess.
No, there doesn't. I mean, and the thing is we actually, before the commission came into place, and it was one of the things that we begged you not to do, because we had a private sanctioning body that was doing all this, that was actually doing the blood tests. In fact, we had actually kind of gone beyond what the commission does currently. The commission, and they want to revert back to this. Here's kind of an example without killing you with boring details. They want to have fighters take pre-screening MRIs. The World Council of Neurologists, who do a convention on concussions in sports, have come out and said flat out that's the wrong way to go. The MRIs are not predictive. What they actually encourage instead is what's called a SCAT-2 test, which is nice because it can be administered by a layman and then reviewed by a doctor. The great thing about the SCAT-2 is it sets a return-to-play guideline that the MRIs or any of these other tests cannot do. So our commission wanted to head along that road. That all got killed when the state founded their commission, and we were hoping on bended knee that the state would appoint people that understood the sport. That did not happen. But I'm not entirely certain that even if it did, it would matter, because that, like I said, that $100,000 in salary is just, that's a big hill for us to climb, because the sport is pretty small. So you can have a sanctioning body, and I would actively encourage, and we do this when we go on the, we have a show at Treasure Island coming up. That show will be overseen, you know, by the mixed martial arts sanctioning group.
Well,
right? And we will follow the unified rules and the health and safety guidelines set forth by the ABC, by the unified rules, by the Nevada Commission, and by the ISKA.
Treasure Island's a separate nation.
Correct. But
they don't have to pay attention to any laws that we have here.
Right, but the sport does. Mixed martial arts, the promoters of mixed martial arts, the last thing they want to do, and it's funny because I think people that aren't familiar with the sport, they think it's just two guys trying to kill one another. And actually, the last thing we ever want to see in a sport, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen because it happens in football, it happens in a lot of sports, is somebody gets hurt. The last thing we ever want to do is see that backboard come out. We don't ever want to see somebody carried out on a stretcher. I mean, obviously, we train these guys, we're friends with them, they're our family, they're our kids, so, you know, we certainly don't want to see that on that level. But the promoters, no matter how cutthroat or cold-blooded they are, they're not going to want to see it for a pragmatic reason. This is a huge liability that they take. They're going to be the first ones on the plane. Plus, it kills the show, you know. I mean, nobody pays money to want to see that. Nobody wants to see EMTs work. So this is not, I mean, it's just one of those things that any promoter with half a brain is going to want to sanction anybody, because they also don't want to have to deal with complaints of a crooked referee or ridiculous judges or whatever.
We have a question by Representative Sanders.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of the questions I had, you have. I guess I'll just take a one next step. If we don't have a governing body, are we going to get the big premier fights? Are we going to get Brock Lesnar at, you know, a UFC card and at the Target Center, the Excel Center, if we don't have something like the combative sports
system? Yeah, there's every reason to believe that we will. And I'll actually kind of come back. I think one of the reasons we haven't had the UFC back is because of this commission. The UFC sold out in under 24 hours. 24 hours of announcing that they were going to do a show here. When they opened ticket sales, they were sold out. That was pretty good. Now, that's about a $3.5 million gate. Brock Lesnar, between his pay and his sponsors, made about $2.5 million, all of which Minnesotans got taxes out of. That's a pretty good deal.
Absolutely.
Now, the commission charged the UFC $80,000 to oversee that show. What they gave the commission was four inspectors, four pretty poorly trained inspectors, to be honest, because two of them were actually the children of commissioners. When we go to do a show I'll go down to Dallas to do Showtime next week. And when I go down there, we will have an inspector for every single one of the fighters. We will work with the commission all the way through. It's a much more complicated process to have a really solid commission than what we have in place right now. But they charged the UFC $80,000. Now, they also took from the UFC between $60,000 to $80,000 worth of tickets that were given to friends, family, political allies, in some cases political enemies. And there was actually a legislative audit done on the commission where they were found in violation of multiple ethics violations. One of the reasons the UFC has not come back, and I can tell you, Scott Coker from Strikeforce has said very clearly, Jack Bateman from W1, Bellator, have all told me they rejected Minnesota as sites to come and do shows because they don't want to get soaked by a commission. Because they don't, I mean, and they'll take it when they go to Nevada because they get all of these other things along with it. They get testing, their referees are trained, they really have a very tight program in place. But those programs have shows like this on a monthly basis so they can deal with budgets that are, you know, in over $1 million, which is what this state would need to do, you know, to be able to provide the same level of service, which obviously I'm not here asking you to spend another $920,000 on this commission. I mean, I think it's one of those things that really it'd be a pretty simple fix for the city of Minneapolis to create health and safety standards, and that's really what they're looking for is health and safety standards.
Well, thank you very much for your information, and I promise we will be checking with the House attorneys to see if there is any obligation from the state to have one. Know that right now the Combative Sports Commission is not getting one dime of your tax dollars. This is effective June 30th or July 1st, which whatever date is
first.
July 1st. And if your compadres decide to pay a fee of $45 or whatever it is, then you're perpetuating it, not me.
Well, right now we're legally obligated if we want to compete in our sport to do it. But if there isn't that huge expenditure, I'm sure that they'll be able to snap to.
So somebody that was a compadre of yours decided to do that several years ago, and I can't discontinue it because of your testimony, but your testimony has been very enlightening, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again.
All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
And with that, we have a presentation from the MAP. Sorry, we had another one sneak in on us. The Minnesota Youth Program, Minneapolis Youth Programs, are here to testify.
This is the only
one. And I just want you to know one thing, you're keeping us from supper.
Keeping ourselves from supper, too, Mr. Chair. So we do apologize. We're all hungry and ready to go. So we do appreciate your time.
We're glad you let us know. We wanted to hear from you.
This is for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Melissa Reed with the City of Minneapolis.
My name is Kirk Peterson, Rice, Michaels, and Walther, representing the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board.
And Mr. Chair, members, we just have a letter here from our chair of the Minneapolis Workforce Council. She was unable to be here, and our staff had to leave earlier. So we'd just like to share with you those comments, and then all of us go have a nice dinner. Members of the committee, this is on behalf of Carolyn Robbie, chair of the Minneapolis Workforce Council. I'm writing to share my perspective on the value of providing a direct allocation for the City of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board's youth employment programs. As a business leader and chair of the Minneapolis Workforce Council, I know firsthand about the value of youth employment programs and the importance of maintaining a stable service delivery structure. When looking at the 25 largest metropolitan areas in the country, the employment disparities in the greater Twin Cities metropolitan area are greater than any other region. One of the most efficient and effective strategies for addressing this growing set of disparities is by investing in summer youth employment programs. Summer programs provide meaningful work experience and a chance for a young person to tap their potential and learn the value of earning a paycheck. In addition, they provide valuable work readiness training that teaches youth how to get and keep a job. Without this training and coaching, many youth from low-income families will never get a job and break the cycle of intergenerational poverty. If we don't invest in diverse youth, this disparity will grow, causing deeper economic disadvantages and leaving Minnesota talent on the table. The Summer Youth Employment Program provides the tools so that all youth can be successful participants in the job market. Ultimately, our regional economy and our state benefit from these services by increasing the skill level and productivity of our future workforce. I'm deeply concerned about proposals that would undermine the success of the Minneapolis youth employment programs by further delaying their ability to deliver quality employment opportunities to our youth this year. An additional competitive process added to Minneapolis's existing competitive process would put core services in jeopardy at a time when youth employment programs could not be more critical for the competitiveness of our state. The Minneapolis Workforce Council thanks the committee for their thoughtful consideration. Respectfully, Carolyn Robbie, Chair of the Minneapolis Workforce Council. And I would simply add that the concern that Chair Michelle addressed a few moments ago about the timeline of these programs, many of our youth are already in orientation and pre-training programs for this summer's training. So a delay in that, in the beginning of that, would be very beneficial for our youth this summer.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Michelle. I mean, Senator Michelle.
Ms. Reed, thank you. And I did want to talk just briefly about the timeline, just so I understand it. So can you help me with a couple hypotheticals here? And I assure you these are totally hypothetical. If for some reason the legislature was not able to agree on a final budget by May 23rd, what would that do to your summer program?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that would eliminate our summer program.
Let me ask again in a different way. If the legislature and the governor, for some reason, totally hypothetical, were not able to agree on a budget by July 1st, what would that do to your program?
Mr. Chair and committee members, by July 1st, I believe that would also eliminate our summer program.
Okay. So no matter what, you're tied to this crazy 2 weeks here at the state capitol, and you said you have kids in orientation for the summer already.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, they since they have not finished school, they have not begun working yet, but they're in orientation within the city, kind of getting prepared to work for the summer. Yes. And if I could add, Mr. Chair, just so the committee understands the need that we have in Minneapolis, we have previously planned for 500 youth in the city's version of the program, and the Park Board also employs, I believe, an additional 220 youth. 120?
270.
270, excuse me. And our goal these last year was 500 youth. We were able to employ 650 youth through leveraging some other resources. We have, for this year, over 4,000 applicants for those 500 slots. So we do have a need, and we are able to fill those slots. We do have a lot of youth looking for those opportunities.
Just out of curiosity, how many summer youth programs does Minneapolis have?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I want to talk about it in terms of both what we do with the park board and the city, because, you know, we are looking at the same population of young people. We have summer youth programs. I have a handout, actually, that might be in your packets. We have youth employment programs that run year-round. During the summer, though, is when we really specialize in the Step Up program, and then we partner with the park board to have youth working in different opportunities in the parks program. So I think those are our two main.
How about Boys and Girls Club?
The Boys and Girls Club, Mr. Chair, is a separate program.
It's in Minneapolis?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. It's not run by the city. It's located in Minneapolis. We have a branch in Minneapolis, and they employ similar populations of young people, but the city-run program itself is separate from the Boys and Girls Club.
So I believe in total there are five summer youth programs that are held in Minneapolis every summer. Is that correct?
That may be accurate. I'm only aware specifically the ones that we run, but that sounds like a ballpark accurate number.
Okay. There's Youth Build is a good program. You build houses for people that Respice might have. A program, what is that one they have that build houses for people?
Habitat
for Humanity. And we have Boys and Girls Club in the city I live in. That's the only one we have. It's not a small town, 11,000. But Minneapolis seems to have a proliferation of them. And I think, according to a statement Commissioner McElroy made, that when we discontinued the one in the parks, the rate of crime in the parks increased tremendously.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So it's something that Minneapolis has a little better than everybody else. They probably need it.
Huh? We would agree, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, real quickly.
Go ahead.
The cardinal rule of lobbying, don't stand behind it between a hungry conference committee and dinner, so I'll make it real brief. The Park Board does run a separate program, Learn to Earn, or as they call it, a Teen Teamworks program. I won't go into the details. They serve at-risk youth like some of the other programs, but we put kids to work right in the local parks in their local communities. We also give them academic training during the course of the summer. We do match our state funding with park board city money, also occasionally federal money and private money, so we do leverage private sector dollars. Real quick concerns with this. Most of these have been addressed by other presenters, so I won't go over them again. The timing, Senator Michelle brought up the timing. We have already collected over 1,300 applications. We stopped taking applications. We know that with the level of funding that we received in the past and what we have on hand, we're going to be able to employ somewhere around 200 to 300, and we just quit taking applications. Between the time that they get the grant process set up through DEED, they get the grants, they get the applications out, we get responses back in, half of our summer work season is going to be gone. These kids are out working in the parks. They're mowing, they're cutting trees, they're filling potholes in the paths. They're going to miss a half of a work season. We're not going to know if we're going to be able to get them out that quickly, so we're concerned about the timing. Secondly, the structure. We are very comfortable with the results that we have in the past. We think our program stands on our own with what the legislature has expected us to do. But a lot of these programs were set up for specific needs and specific reasons, and now we might be getting into an apples to oranges comparison. We target at-risk youth, kids with gang problems, drug problems, academic deficiencies, all sorts of things. Are these kids now going to be going up against disabled veterans or out-of-work pipe fitters? Those are the kinds of things that we're facing now. What are we going to be competing against? And again, you really have two or more different target markets when you start comparing and combining these different job programs. Finally, Mr. Chairman, transparency is another thing that's been talked about in the past. I know you guys get a lot of paperwork. You probably don't want to read this right now, but I did bring a copy of our most recent annual report. This is something we provide
to DEED and back to the legislature every year. Every year we come here and you ask us what we've done with our money. Here it is. We come back and we tell you how many kids we've hired, what kind of work they've done, what their academic progress has been. So as far as transparency and accountability, we think we're right up there. But if there's more that we can do on that end, we're happy to work with you or with DEED to provide that. So we think we have that covered. So with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any questions, that's all I have to say.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Again, and so maybe this is a follow-up to my earlier hypotheticals, but this one isn't hypothetical. So in either of these youth summer employment programs, you've got some in the pipeline now, kind of an orientation, Ms. Reed does. So you're assuming or kind of making a bet that you are going to get funded at some level, because I don't know how else you would run a summer 2011 program. So every spring you have to somehow forecast or estimate what you're going to get from state government or other sources. Am I reading that wrong?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Michelle, we don't think that we're entitled to this money just because we've got it in the past. I want to be clear about that. Anything that we receive from the state is very much appreciated, and it's on top, but help us boost what we can do. The year that Representative Gunther mentioned that we didn't get state funding, we were only able to employ, I believe it was 90-some kids. Last year we did over 270. And so it makes it hard to determine, but we don't go in saying, oh, we got, you know, 300 grand last year, we're going to get that again next year. We just don't take that for granted.
And, Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to say that there was any kind of sense of entitlement by either of these groups. That's just the way the calendar is. The legislature does a two-year budget, and we never get done early, right? We never get done early, so it's May at the earliest, but you already have something in the works. You have to have something in the works, and so I'm just trying to figure out how do you forecast or predict or guess what kind of a program, what kind of size, what kind of funding you're going to get. You just base it on history?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, that has been our model of managing that as best we can, yes, based on historical funding levels.
Mr. Chairman, we haven't gone down that road that far yet. We've actually held off on hiring because we are in that uncertain stage. We've collected applications, but we don't want to tell a bunch of kids, you know, that are already disadvantaged and in many cases downtrodden, hey, you've got a job, and, oh, you know what, now you're out of a job again. So we've been holding off and just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen.
Well, thank you very much. Any members have any other questions? If not, I want to personally tell you I think you do a very good job.
Thank you, sir.
And with that, we have gone through quite a few testifiers, and we get done in earlier than I ever thought we could.
Did you?
I thought it was going to be closer to 9.
Because Hoppy was gone.
Hoppy was gone. He made a difference. So. But anyway, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.